Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
And by the way, as I said earlier, we are going to spend a full 1 hour tonight with our special guest, Geronimo Jijaga. You know him as Geronimo Pratt. We're going to spend a full hour with Geronimo tonight, and his co-counsel, Johnny Cochran, joins us live from New York. When we come back, I want to ask Johnny what got him so passionate about this case in the first place, why he took it on, and why for 27 years he stayed with this case. For the full hour tonight, we'll take your phone calls. Stay with us. We're back on the other side of this break. You, what in the first place made you take this case on? Go back 27 years. Tell us why you took this case, why you were so passionate about it then, and why you stuck with this thing for 27 years.
Well, Geronimo and I had met in another trial, the so-called L.A. Panther shootout case that at the time was the longest trial in L.A. history. We tried that case, I believe, in 1969 or so, 69 or 70, and Geronimo and I got to know each other. Later on, I was appointed to represent him by Judge Kathleen Parker in the so-called Santa Monica Tennis Court murders. And from the very beginning, I believed that Geronimo Pratt was innocent. He said he was innocent, and everything pointed to that. And so I believed in that. And, you know, we had one of the key things that really bound us early on was that Geronimo Pratt was real young, 20, 21 at the time. But he would always say to me, "Cochran, they're out to get us." And I would say with skepticism, "What are you talking about, they? Who are you talking about? What do you mean by that?" And so, and I would accuse him of being paranoid in a kind of a joking way. But as the time passed by, I was this older lawyer. I was in my 20s, but I was older than he was. At any rate, he was right. They were out to get him. We couldn't put a name on it at the time, but he was a victim of the FBI's counterintelligence program. And so one of the things you do when you have a client that you really believe in, who is innocent, you believe he's innocent, and you, with all your heart you believe that, and we became not only a client lawyer, we became friends and we became brothers, you continue to fight. And through, with the help of Stuart Hanlon, a great amount of help from Stuart Hanlon, we got this information from the Freedom of Information Act, from the FBI, which revealed that Geronimo was in fact right. He was a victim of the FBI's counterintelligence program, and they were out to get him. So we kind of kid each other now when I say he was right and I was wrong. And you know, that experience made me a much better lawyer. It made me question the official view. But over the years, I remember the first time I went to see Geronimo Pratt after he was convicted in July of 1972. And I remember him saying to me, "You know, don't forget me, Cochran." And I never did, and I never would. And, you know, this was just a situation where we could not rest until he was free.
And those who've read your book, Journey to Justice, know that you start out the preface of your book, spending the entire preface, quite frankly, talking about this case, and this is the case that meant the most to you, despite the fact that most of us know you because of the O.J. case.
That's true. This was the most important case in my life, and the day that Geronimo Pratt was released from custody was the most important and satisfying victory of my whole life.
Let's take some phone calls. We have got a lot to talk to Geronimo Jijaga about tonight, but we'll start with our phone calls tonight in California. Molly, thanks for holding. You're on BET Talk.
Hello, Tavis.
Hello.
Johnny Cochran and Geronimo Jijaga.
Hello, how are you doing?
All right, congratulations to both of you. And I know tomorrow's O.J.'s birthday, Johnny, so congratulations. What a present for you.
Okay.
My comment to you is that both of you know that we as grassroots organization, and the grassroots organization, Front Page, Talk Radio, we have followed you for 27 years. How much that this helped to get you released, Geronimo Jijaga, and how helpful was it to you, Johnny Cochran? I'll listen to your comments off the air because the struggle continues, but always, to God be the glory.
Molly,
thanks
for your phone call. I think what she's asking, Geronimo, is how important was the media, the black media, in helping you get released? How important was the black media in getting this story and keeping it out there during the entire time you were incarcerated?
I think it was very important, very essential, for a lot of developments. I think I would have been murdered in prison quite a number of times if black media wouldn't have come through.
You believe that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But they also were targeted by COINTELPRO. This war, this secret war, was very vicious, and I think it was worthy of much more study than has been done thus far.
Right.
It was a sweltering day in early September 1972. I was 34 years old. I had tried and won 10 murder cases in a row. I had my confidence. I was on a roll. Then I agreed to defend Geronimo Pratt. Geronimo was innocent. We were friends. I had never cared about a client as deeply as I did him. And now I was on my way to visit Pratt in the prison where the state of California intended to keep him for the rest of his life. What happened? What went wrong? As I was driving north out of San Francisco on that sweltering day, Pratt's trial was still fresh in my mind. As I headed for San Quentin, I replayed it over and over in my head. Most of all, I recalled the moment less than 2 months before when Judge Kathleen Parker's bailiff had intoned the familiar, "All rise," and we stood to hear the jury's verdict. Pratt's trial on charges of murder, robbery, and aggravated assault had been hard fought, but no more difficult than many others I had won over the years. Still, I was inordinately tense as Judge Parker scanned the verdicts, then handed them to her clerk to be read. From the start, an indescribable undercurrent had surged beneath the surface of the Pratt case. Like an underground river, dark and hidden, it had silently eaten away at the very foundations of my confidence in the integrity of the criminal justice system. My client, the leader of the Black Panther Party's Los Angeles office, had insisted from the start of his case was about something else. "They're out to get me, Cochran," he said over and over, "and they're going to do whatever they have to do." But I was an experienced attorney. I dealt in facts, not in conspiratorial fantasies. With all they had on their minds in those turbulent years, it seemed somehow improbable to me that federal, state, and local authorities would plot secretly together to persecute a single Vietnam veteran whose worst fault was a taste for hyperbolic revolutionary jargon. But as Geronimo and I stood shoulder to shoulder to hear his fate pronounced, why was my stomach heaving? "The defendant will face the jury," Judge Parker instructed, and Geronimo and I turned as if in harness. I scanned the jurors' faces. They did not return my gaze. "We, the jury, in the above action, find the defendant." I had done my best, but suddenly, for perhaps the first time, I wondered if it really had been enough. "Guilty, as charged, of the crime of murder." A few weeks later, on August 29th, Judge Parker denied without comment my motion for a new trial and sentenced Geronimo Pratt to life in prison. In the days that followed, there were rumors and whispers, glimmers of dark secrets. I had begun to learn things, though not nearly as much as I intended to know. One of us indeed had been living in a fantasy world, but it wasn't my client. I had come to San Quentin, in part, to tell Geronimo that. The guard who escorted me to the 3-by-5-foot cubicle set aside for visiting lawyers and their clients smiled chillingly as he opened the door. This, he informed me, was the very room in which George Jackson had been handed a gun by his lawyer shortly before his fatal escape attempt. Pratt was in solitary confinement, where he would remain for the next 8 years, and they brought him to me chained hand and foot. He wore a white jumpsuit with a huge black X stenciled on its back. "Cochran," he said matter-of-factly, "this thing on my back is a target. When I walk across the yard, if I fall down, they will shoot and kill me." We sat across from each other at a wooden table, a metal screen between us. We talked for hours without ceasing. Then the walls of that tiny room began to close in on me. I felt suddenly desperate, as if I might be going mad. It was time to go. We rose and put our hands together against the screen. Don't forget me, Cochran, he said. I won't. I promised. And I never have. Driving back toward San Francisco, I approached the Golden Gate Bridge, and all at once, its storied beauty seemed somehow forbidding and tragic, part of another world in which people lived happily and unburdened. If I was to keep my promise to Geronimo Pratt, if I was to complete this journey to justice on which I had embarked, I would need more strength than I ever had imagined. I knew just where to find it. As I have so many times in my life, I recall the words of the prophet Isaiah. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. That's the thing about roots. They nourish you, and a man who has them always knows where he stands. My own roots run through the rich black earth of my family's love, across the continent, and back nearly 60 years to a clapboard house on a red dirt hill in Shreveport, Louisiana, and to the Little Union Baptist Church where I first heard the voices that have been with me ever since. That is Johnny L. Cochran Jr., Journey to Justice, and actually that is the preface to Journey to Justice, which is fascinating because this book that I read so much of from the O.J. Simpson trial ends with the O.J. Simpson trial. Whew. Context to White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, The Cows Book Club. Today's date, Thursday, March 4th, 2021. So I have been told. Maybe the greatest 1-2 book combo that we have read in sequence in the 11-year history, or now 10-year history, of the Cows Book Club. Now, I will say, we did read the autobiography of Malcolm X and the autobiography of Assata Shakur back-to-back, 2015. So that's pretty high up there. We had pretty robust participation. Those are very important books, very similar, same type of a thing, same subject matter. Some of the same figures are talked about in both books. Malcolm X is certainly talked about in Asada's book. So that some competition. But all of that said, wow. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, the great Tavis Smiley, the grandsister, Johnny L. Cochran Jr., the grandsister, Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, Vietnam veteran, two tours. As he stated, there is so much studying that needs to be done about COINTELPRO and the system of white supremacy racism. That is one reason out of many, many why we are reading this here book. Again, what a follow to the O.J. Simpson trial. Johnny Cochran, front and center, talk about, and did you hear that? He's not into all those conspiracy theories, trying to make up fantasy and what have you after we get done with O.J. Simpson. And now, Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, the book we're reading, Jack Olson's The Last Man, it is Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. Absolutely amazing. I will hush and we will get started. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment one, Last Man Standing. Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt, written by Jack Olson. For Kathleen Ryan, her memory. And judgment is turned away backward, and justice standeth afar off, for truth is fallen in the street. Isaiah chapter 59, verse 14. Prologue, 1975. Stuart Hanlon steered his Toyota Junkster under the barn red towers of the Golden Gate Bridge on his way to visit a convicted murderer named Elmer Gerard Geronimo Pratt. The impromptu trip to San Quentin was the idea of a radical social worker and friend. "This guy needs some help," the woman had told Hanlon in a breathless phone call. "He's been in a cage for 5 years. He was a Black Panther leader, but they threw him out. His family's 2,000 miles away, and he's about as alone as you can get." "What's he in for?" Hanlon had asked. "Murder, but he didn't do it." Driving north on Highway 101, the law student remembered a cynical line from a lecturer at Hastings College of Law. "There are 4,000 inmates in San Quentin, and 5,000 of them were framed." He wished he knew more about the case. The fact that Pratt was a Black Panther leader was no recommendation. At 25, Stuart Douglas Hanlon tended to distrust authority figures of any color. "I've never met a leader who wasn't an asshole," he told friends. "Having power and having brains are two different things." His views had been reinforced by his own arrest on a charge of attempted murder of a police officer during the 1968 student riots at Columbia University, a charge that was quickly dismissed. Hanlon parked and walked along a winding path through a cheery garden court that only seemed to amplify the menace behind the walls. He wondered how his Jufro would play with guards who favored brush cuts and flat tops. At other penal institutions, the staff glared at him as though he were smuggling contraband in his frizzy hairdo. Friends at law school dubbed him Pigpen and suggested that it was time to buy a few rep ties and shoelaces and take pruning shears to his hair. Soon he would be competing with polished young lawyers with station wagon accents and blow-dried coiffures, and certain judges might look askance at his sartorial nonchalance. He remembered another law school truism: "Someday one of your clients will go to jail because the judge didn't like your tie." Hanlon rode a bench outside the San Quentin visiting room for 2 hours while chattering jailhouse annies fussed at the admitting officers. At 11 a.m., he was ushered into the narrow visiting room for prisoners in solitary confinement and directed to chair number 4. On the opposite side of a heavy gauge metal screen, a light-skinned African-American shuffled forward in Fu Manchu half-steps and lowered himself onto a metal bench. Hanlon's first reaction was that he was looking into a photo negative of himself. Both men had thick black mustaches, goatees, and large hair. 4 other inmates arrived, each facing his own visitor. All wore handcuffs and belly chains. Hanlon asked, "Are you Geronimo?" The black man nodded. He seemed fidgety. "I'm Stu Hanlon," he said, pressing his hand against the screen in a visiting room handshake. "I'm a law student. A friend said I might be able to help you." Pratt frowned. 2 whitish scars, a little smaller than dimes, seemed to come together on his forehead. "Hey, man," he began, then lowered his voice. "This isn't a good time. Maybe..." Hanlon heard the scrape of metal on metal. Pratt's voice dropped to a hoarse whisper, and his words became inaudible. He seemed more focused on the prisoner seated alongside him than on his visitor. Then Hanlon realized that an inmate farther down the row had slipped his chains. "Don't do it," a female visitor yelled. The unshackled inmate tackled a guard who just entered the enclosure and slashed at his olive drab jacket with a knife. As alarms blared, Geronimo Pratt flung himself between the two men and knocked the guard into a sitting position. He knelt on the officer's torso and thighs, pinning him to the floor. In the confusion, it appeared that Pratt might be kicking at the prostrate guard's side, but Hanlon's view was partially blocked and he couldn't be sure. Then a team of officers burst in and everyone went down in a scrum of olive drab and prison blues, kicks, yells, whacks, curses, and blood. Before Hanlon and his fellow visitors were rushed from the area, the frightened law student saw a huge guard slam Pratt's head against the wall. At home that night, Hanlon kept asking himself, "What the hell happened? What did I see?" He replayed the scene in his mind. He was sure he'd seen Pratt slide his husky body between knife and victim. But he'd also seen Pratt trying to hold the guard down. Hanlon asked himself, "What was Pratt trying to tell me? This isn't a good time." If he was in on the assault, why did he interfere? Or was I just seeing things? He didn't sleep well. Hanlon was surprised when he was asked to appear as a defense witness at the disciplinary hearing in San Quentin's Adjustment Center, a secure area reserved for the most dangerous convicts. He told the blank-faced hearing officers exactly what he'd seen, and hadn't. No, he had not observed inmate Pratt attack corrections officer Michael M. Yes, it did appear that Pratt had helped knock the guard to the floor. Hanlon told the officials that in his opinion, Pratt might have saved M's life, but he couldn't be sure. It was Rashomon. There could be as many versions as there'd been participants. He was ushered out before the verdict was returned. A week later, Hanlon's request to revisit Pratt was denied by a guard at the reception desk. "Mr. Pratt is in a disciplinary cell." "I'm his attorney," Hanlon explained. It was almost true. He was thinking about making Pratt his first client as soon as he passed the bar examination. He was ushered into a small room reserved for legal visits. The guard slammed the metal door and told him to ring the bell when he was ready to leave. Pratt materialized like a shackled ghost on the other side of a thick sheet of clear plastic. As the prisoner settled into his straight-backed chair, Hanlon spotted something shiny on the floor next to his foot. It was a large afro comb. The teeth had been broken off and the edge sharpened. "Don't touch that," Pratt yelled. "It's a setup." Hanlon pushed the bell and an officer chugged into the room. "What's the problem?" he asked. Hanlon pointed to the floor. "Okay, okay," the guard said impatiently. "Hand it to me." Pratt was shaking his head emphatically. Hanlon said, "I'm not touching it. Pick it up yourself." "Give it to me, now." The law student took a deep breath. "Go ahead and arrest me," he said. "I'm not touching that thing." The guard bent over and picked up the cone. Then he announced that the visit was over. At first, Geronimo Pratt hadn't known what to make of the earnest young man with the big hair. Perhaps he was the law student he claimed to be, but he could also be a plant. Whoever he was, he'd picked a bad time to acquaint himself with prison life. Visitors were a welcome relief from the tedium of the hole, but on this day, racial tensions were running high and an attack was planned on a guard who was rumored to be involved in a campaign to set up a black female inmate for murder. Footnote 1. A rumor that, like so many others in the paranoid atmosphere of the hole within a hole, called the Adjustment Center, proved false. It was the latest skirmish in a running war between African American prisoners and their overseers. Each side considered the other fair game, and each side gave no quarter. In solitary confinement, since his first day in prison, Pratt had tried to remain aloof from the bloodletting. He'd made a life decision to avoid prison gangs and personal feuds. It was the only way to stay alive. Guards and inmates would be attacked from time to time, and there was nothing he could do about it. The homemade knife had been wielded by Alonzo Brown, a black revolutionary from Pennsylvania. In the upside-down prison culture, Brown was a figure of power and prestige. Prisoners had named children after him. To speak against him or interfere with his planned attack would have been suicidal. Pratt had felt almost relieved to be swarmed by the other guards and thrown against the wall. His last sight before falling had been the distorted image of the law student on the other side of the screen, eyes protruding, mouth open in shock. In the aftermath, Pratt was grateful to the wounded guard for playing the deadly prison game with honor. Michael L. M., a fellow Vietnam veteran, prepared a report that seemed deliberately vague and ambiguous. As the grill gate was opening, the young officer wrote, I noticed that Brown's restraint belt was unbuckled and he was holding his hands over his stomach. I quickly closed the grill gate and reached for Brown's restraint belt, at which time he turned to face me, and by unfolding his hands, he pulled out a knife. He then came at me with knife in his right hand. I backed up toward the wall, peripherally observed the form of a black inmate who I cannot identify, who grabbed me from behind and pushed me to the floor. I landed on the floor in a semi-sitting position with my legs outstretched and my back against the wall. Another black inmate, who I cannot identify, grasped my left shoulder and attempted to hold me while Brown kept stabbing at me with the knife. Grappling with Brown to avoid being stabbed, I managed to get to my feet. The business end of Alonzo Brown's cloth-wrapped shank was a 3-inch blade sharpened on both edges, ground down from flat metal, perhaps part of a bed frame. Michael M. was lucky. The heaviest blow had slashed his heavy Department of Corrections jacket and nicked his chest. He was also treated for cuts on his lip and wrist. On his third visit to the penitentiary, Stuart Hanlon asked, What was the ruling? Guilty, Pratt answered through the slit. Didn't the guard tell him you saved his life? Nope. This is a war, man. If Mike M. testifies that I helped him, I'm dead meat with the other inmates. It's a game. You follow the rules or they take you out. Pratt said the disciplinary committee had sentenced him to 3 more years in solitary confinement. 3 more? Hanlon said. He'd heard of difficult prisoners being sentenced to the hole for 30 days or even a few months. But 3 years? He asked, How long have you been in the hole? This is my 5th year. The hole isn't my main problem. My main problem is staying alive. You got a bed? A toilet? The toilet's a hole in the floor. I got a bed now, but for a long time I slept on the floor. In my own... His voice trailed off. Hanlon was unprepared for Pratt's story. The law student was the semi-hippified product of a middle-class home, a graduate of the Riverside Country Day School for Boys, for rich Jewish kids, as he described it later, and Columbia University. He was the son of a gentle housewife who was descended from Russian Jews, and a placid Irish Catholic father who taught math and English at the Dalton School for Girls in Manhattan. Hanlon had taken a course in penology and presumed that even in the worst holes in the worst prisons, inmates slept on bunks and were provided toilets. Yet Pratt didn't seem to be whining or complaining, just stating the facts. Hanlon wondered if 4 years in solitary had institutionalized him, brought him to that flat-eyed state of indifference that came over long-term prisoners. Somehow, Hanlon doubted it. There was still a fire in Pratt's brown eyes, a firmness to his motions and reactions as their first lengthy discussion continued. The caged man made random references to Schopenhauer, Hegel, Spinoza, and other philosophers, mispronouncing some of the names. His milk chocolate skin seemed to glow with intensity as he spoke. At Columbia, Hanlon had argued late into the night over the same deep thinkers. He found himself intrigued by the symmetry. Considering that Pratt was living in a steel box, he appeared surprisingly fit. He explained that every morning he reverted to his army drill sergeant role and led calisthenics in the block. He looked to be a little below average height, maybe 5'6 or 5'7, but his shoulders were wide and his arm muscles rippled against the sleeves of his GI fatigue top. Hanlon thought there was a dull burnish cast to his features, a Eurasian touch. Or was it Byzantine? He thought, how silly that we call this man black or Negro or colored. Pratt was a hybrid. His nose was on the thin side and slightly turned up at the tip, like Hanlon's. His dark brownish hair was finely textured. When he saw Hanlon studying his hairline, he said, "Down home, we call this white man hair. I always wanted a big woolly bully afro, but my longest was an inch or two. My daddy's hair was straight. It's our blood. Irish, African, French, Cajun, Indian." He pointed to Hanlon's head and said, "What do you call that mess?" Hanlon laughed. "It's my Jufro," he said. "I'm half Jewish." "Far out. And half African?" "My dad's Irish and my mom's Jewish." Pratt grinned, showing perfect teeth. "You should call it a mikfro," he said. After a few hours, they were warned that their time was up. As Pratt clanked back into the shadows in his shackles, he called out, "Hey, Hanlon, check my file at the DA's office, will you? My counselor says they brought some more charges against me." "For what?" He couldn't hear the answer. The young lawyer detoured to the nearby Marin County Courthouse. As he walked across the courthouse parking lot, he felt a shiver despite the silvery California sun that bounced off the angled planes of the Frank Lloyd Wright building. 4 years earlier, in this same parking lot, a 17-year-old black youth had tried to flee in a van carrying three accomplices and several hostages. In a firefight, police sharpshooters killed the young man and two of his accomplices, but a judge's head was blown off and an assistant district attorney critically wounded. Hanlon walked where blood had ebbed into a storm drain. In the records of the county DA's office, he found a short notation about the visiting room stabbing case. The reason Elmer Pratt will not be prosecuted is because bringing him to court would provide him with an escape opportunity and because he did not personally attempt to assault Mr. M. Hanlon thought, escape opportunity? Who are we dealing with here? Attila the Hun? On his next visit, he asked, Geronimo, how come everybody's so scared of you? Pratt winced. Check my jacket, man. They wrote me up for everything except the Brinks robbery. Making poison darts, rioting in court, breaking out my homies, trying to hijack the prison school bus and kill a kid a day. Cut off their heads. Hannon gulped. Was any of it true? Pratt leaned into the speaking slot and began a defense of his innocence, ticking off his points with the metronomic precision of a trial attorney. In the end, he apologized for his intensity. But that's the way it was. The son of a bitches wanted to get me, and the son of a bitches got me. What son of a bitches are we talking about? Hanlon asked. Everybody. The LAPD? The courts? The judges? Hanlon asked where he could find the records on the case. You want to check me out? Pratt sounded defensive. See Johnny Cochran. Who's he? My lawyer in LA. He's the only one I trust. Hanlon met with Pratt's attorney in the back seat of a Rolls-Royce sedan on a Los Angeles street corner, an abrupt session that had been arranged by Cochran on the run. We'll talk more tonight, he said rapidly. I just wanted to shake hands with a friend of Geronimo's. Hanlon took note of the lawyer's appearance. He wore his hair in a short natural and sported a hand-painted tie, highly shined shoes, and creased pants. The law student observed a row of crystal glasses in the back of the silver shadow sedan. Cochran said, That's my minibar. I don't drink. It's for my friends. Man, the ex-hippie blurted out, You are really fucked up. Cochran laughed and said, True. Hanlon thought, this is two different ozones coming together, but in reverse. The black guys got the roles. That night, they had a longer meeting in Cochran's office. It all comes out the same, the lawyer said, beckoning towards stacks of files. An innocent guy was found guilty, and I lost the case. Was it a fix? Hanlon asked. Cochran said, When we were getting ready for trial, Pratt kept telling me that the whole thing was political. Said somebody just wanted to neutralize him and the Black Panthers. I kept asking, Who's somebody? He kept saying, I wish I knew. That's about what he told me. I said, Son, you've got a vivid imagination. I told him I'd won 10 straight murder cases and he would be the 11th. I said, We've got the facts and the DA's got nothing. So this college kid says, You're wrong, Cochran. We got to find out what's behind all this, or I'm going to prison. Well, he was right and I was wrong. Now he's in his fifth year in solitary and I'm still losing sleep. Hanlon asked, no question, he's innocent? None. The guy is a victim of a frame-up that goes so high, it's scary. I wouldn't be surprised if the FBI was involved. What's the proof? That's the problem. Hanlon shook his head. How can I help? He asked. Cochran peered across his polished walnut desk. Learn everything you can about the case. Learn about Pratt, who he is, where he's coming from, everything. Research the law and help me find new issues. We've got to get this guy out while he's still alive. Chapter 2, The Pratts of Morgan City. The patriarch, Enoch Jat Pratt Sr., was a stumpy little drayman who sifted the Morgan City dump and hauled his collectibles 99 miles to New Orleans in rattly old trucks that bore the inscription Jack Pratt and Sons. He drove his trucks till they were almost junk themselves. Before school and after school, on Saturdays, and even on holidays, he drove his sons just as hard. His youngest son, Geronimo, born Elmer Gerard, could never shake the smell of burning trash from his nostrils. Daddy taught us to be tough, made us be tough, Pratt said years later. Me and my three brothers, we worked in that fire and smoke till we near dropped, baled up rope, rags, newspapers, ripped the lead plates out of batteries, raked hot ashes for coat hangers and wire springs and bolts. We'd lash up the heavy stuff with chains, mash the 55-gallon drums, drive over bed springs to flatten them, used sledgehammers, double-bladed axes, crowbars, acetylene torches. We could break the wells and chop up a car in an hour. Used wire cutters to strip insulation off house wire till it was top-grade pure metal. We sorted yellow brass, red brass, pewter, nickel, aluminum, tin, carbon. Daddy would drive the stuff home from the dump and store it in our yard, 6-8 feet high. Then we'd load up and head for New Orleans. The Pratt family's first washing and sewing machines came from the dump, as had an upright Stromberg Carlson radio and a black and white TV. Jack Pratt's sons rode bikes assembled from parts. That's where I got these leg muscles, Geronimo explained. Daddy put together an old Schwinn with balloon tires, one speed, no lights, gave it to me for Christmas. You had to be Charles Atlas to pump the pedals. My friends and I would race the white kids, and we weren't gonna lose. With Geronimo or one of his brothers riding shotgun, Jack Pratt would pull out of Morgan City at 2 a.m. to be first in line at Southern Scrap or Ed Levy and Sons or A. Marks in New Orleans. For miles, they drove past whiskey-colored swamp water, cypress knees, palmetto, sawgrass, mangrove shrubs, accented by splashes of color from water hyacinths, crepe myrtle, and azaleas. Jack Pratt shored up the sides of his truck with wooden beams, steel bed frames, and other engineering improvisations so he could haul double loads. As the expeditioners crossed over the narrow Huey P. Long Bridge into New Orleans, the truck yawed and heeled alongside the railroad track that split the roadway down the middle. One day, the brakes gave out at the highest point, and Jack Pratt snubbed the truck against the guardrail for a mile, then pulled to the curb and replaced the linings with a used set he kept in back. Geronimo was always amazed at his father's way with metal. Daddy didn't know what a socket wrench was, didn't own a pipe wrench. Seems like he did everything with a hammer and a chisel. He taught us to harden our hands, use them as tools. After all my years in prison, you still can't hurt my hands with a hammer. As they rattled along Highway 90, the father would say, "Well, son, I think we got about 4 ton on the truck. At $39 a ton, how much that gonna be? Come on, give me that answer right fast." When Geronimo hesitated, his father would say, "Just multiply 4 times 40, son, and subtract 4. Traversing the dank Atchafalaya Basin, Jack Pratt sometimes pulled to the shoulder while one of his sons jumped out to retrieve a treat that had slithered or hopped or lumbered from the swamp. In the junkyards on Carondelet or Chapatoulas Street, fellow devotees of the trash art would ask, "What y'all boys brought us today, Jack?" "A couple of nice rabbits and a snapping turtle," Jack Pratt would reply, "or a pound of meat that used to be a possum." No one wanted to miss out on a serving of fresh wild meat that the junk dealers seared on cracked iron stoves that might have come from Gertie Yost's plush whorehouse on Esplanda Avenue or an antebellum mansion in the Garden District. When the last coil of copper had been weighed out and the last thumb of spun brass chucked into its proper bin, Jack Pratt would steer his truck toward the used clothing stores on South Rampart Street, his favorite place on earth, to begin a friendly ritual he called haggling with the Jews. His closet held a row of neatly pressed suits, and his dress shoes were always buffed to a high shine. If his sons didn't show the same care, he buffed their behinds with the fan belts that he kept around the house for negotiating purposes. The trash picker was idolized by his 7 children. He was a street corner kid, Geronimo remembered. He was the wretched of the earth, raised in Storyville in New Orleans and the back streets of Morgan City. Daddy was a high yellow with white people aspects, a lot of European features, and some Indian too. He was a great dancer, a ladies' man, but hard as oyster shell. Back when the Klan was active, he had his own gang. Whites asked his permission to cross the tracks. We had a reputation. Nobody mess with the guys from across the tracks. White folks called him Mr. Jack. After shopping on Rampart Street, Jack Pratt would drive to the French Market to bargain for the best price on okra, celery, peppers, cress, and watermelon. His last stop was always Schwegman's supermarket, where we would stock up on Snickers bars. His wife Eunice sliced them into 7 parts for her children's desserts. On the return drive southwestward, the port of Morgan City would come into sight as a broken line of cranes and derricks marking the edges of a tidal backwater named after steak. Bayou Boeuf. Barges settled deep in the water under the weight of oil rigs lying flat on their decks. Stevedores worked in the pale bluish light of mercury vapor lamps. Out in the gulf, guttering yellow flares marked offshore wells. The Pratt truck rattled past storage lots and marshalling yards, past blue water rubber and gasket, Hercules wire rope, ABC Bait Company, God's Way Church. The window of Mr. Lucky's Club featured a half-naked woman in neon, legs and breasts flickering enticingly. A sign said, "Hello, we've been waiting for you." With one of his sons stretched out asleep in the passenger seat, Jack Pratt would steer west on Highway 90 past the landlocked shrimp boat Stella Maurice, plying the waves on the median strip for the benefit of tourists, then make a hard left and sound his horn like a riverboat captain in an old movie. In later years, Geronimo Pratt, unable to sleep from persistent shrapnel pain, still heard the horn of his earliest childhood. That meant Daddy's coming. Everybody run out in the backyard to see what he brought. Oh, what a time. What a time. There was a lived-in quality to the black enclave known as Across the Tracks. After a rain, a sharp, salty calcium scent rose from scattered gray mounds of oyster shell. Shotgun houses rested on stilts or bricks against the floods that welled up from the nearby confluence of the Atchafalaya River and Bayou Boeuf. Some of the walls were chinked with animal hair, river mud, and Spanish moss, a mix that dried as hard as concrete. When these houses finally began to collapse, these bucolage walls fell last. Most of the residents of Across the Tracks lived in sagging double wides and weather-stained frame and cinder block cottages with canted one-hole outhouses. Morning glories bloomed atop abandoned machinery rusting on the levee. The neighborhood saloon was the small, unpainted beer garden at 2nd and Union, later renamed the Kick'em Out. Until a black man gained ownership, African Americans were served through a slot in the wall. Next door was a one-chair tonsorial parlor run by Jimmy Harris, a hawk-nosed part Creek. The barber was an elongated version of Jack Pratt and brooked no sass. Above a nest of hair clippings that he swept under a narrow wooden bench polished to a gloss by thousands of posteriors, a sign advised, "The world's gonna end by the 25th. Please pay me now so that I won't have to search all over hell for you." On Saturday mornings, Mr. Jimmy recounted battle stories from World War II as he scissored and razored his customers. He was the first man Geronimo Pratt ever heard use the term civil rights. The Pratt's frame bungalow, a block from the levee, consisted of 4 10-by-10-foot rooms sheltered by a corrugated tin roof that rattled like stage thunder during storms. After every hurricane, there were fresh leaks, and the children caught the water in jars and pots. The house fronted on a bumpy old alley called Arkansas Street, unpaved, potholed, and regularly scoured by floodwaters and floating debris. Some whispered that a black man had been lynched from a hanging tree that had since disappeared into the Pratt's wood stove. As unofficial mayor of Across the Tracks, Jack Pratt discouraged such talk, but he couldn't keep some of his neighbors from referring to Arkansas Street as Death Alley. His scholarly wife, Eunice, the Klan matriarch, banned the morbid name from her domain and declared the lynching to be a mythology. Now and then, a carping historian would express regret at the city father's decision to name the place after an earlier benefactor named Charles Morgan instead of opting for something Gallic in the style of neighboring towns like Payne Courtville, Thibodeau, Labadieville, Bro Bridge, Pierre Part, and Napoleonville. But Morgan City stuck, and the town became known as a Dolores Eden where it took an energetic act of will to go hungry. Crawfish popped out of backyard burrows and begged to be boiled and decapitated and served in steaming bowls of etouffee and biscuit. Residents dined on dishes that outlanders couldn't pronounce. Cochon de lait, coche coche, sacalé, merliton, mache cho. Never mind how it's spelt, just eat. Jack Pratt snapped at relatives and visitors. Eunice Petty Pratt, the drayman's lifelong mate, was his opposite in almost every way. A sweet, spiritual, cultured, and superstitious woman, dark mahogany in color with straight black hair, a tiny waist, and a petite shape that she modestly adorned in light purples and blues. She called herself a gumbo creole, a Bayou euphemism for mixed ancestry. She was born a Catholic and descended from slaves, passants blancs, passing as white. West Indians, a blue-eyed Irish grandmother, a great-grandfather who was manumitted from a sugar plantation in the 1840s, and various Indian tribes. Eunice's father, John Petty, the first black oysterman in Morgan City, had immigrated from the Caribbean to the Bayou Barataria backwaters where Jean Lafitte once moored his pirate ships. Eunice's self-educated mother started the first school for Morgan City's African-American children. Two of her three daughters became college graduates. Eunice was the third. She married Enoch Jack Pratt as a young woman and devoted her life to her family. She spoke excellent English, mixed with Creole, a little French, and some Latin she'd learned in church. Her spiritual life was a mix of Roman Catholicism, random beliefs that went back to slave days, and a soupcon of Cato or Voodoo, locally pronounced hoodoo. Her husband converted to Catholicism for Eunice, but was seldom seen inside the walls of the Black Catholic Church, Holy Eucharist. Whenever she importuned Jack to join her at Mass, he would revert to his own theology. Bible say, I am the church. I, Eunice, me. The presence of God in me is the church, not some drafty old church building where the preacher's trying to screw every woman in town. Sometimes her children found Eunice kneeling in front of a candle and chanting in a tongue they couldn't understand. No, she said, she wasn't speaking in tongues like the Pentecostals. She was just repeating a liturgy passed down from her ancestors all the way back to the Caribbean and West Africa. She wasn't exactly sure where. She drilled her sons in their responses as altar boys. Sicut erat in principio, et nunc et semper, et in saecula saeculorum. When they misspoke, she disciplined them with peach tree switches that she made them cut and peel. Eunice thanked God repeatedly for the miracle he'd wrought on little Gerard, after the other children had begun teasing him for having wheelbarrow legs. She asked for guidance from Saint Gerard, the boy's patron saint, and Saint Jude, the patron saint of impossible causes. Night after night she rubbed the child's bow legs while she chanted and prayed. When they began to grow straighter, she arranged a novena of thanks. Through the years, the healing event became known as an overnight miracle, but the party of the first part wasn't so sure. I think it took a little longer, Geronimo recalled, and my legs never really straightened out. I was the only one in the family who ever questioned what Mama believed. She was so strict and devout, we kids couldn't understand why the Pope didn't canonize her. I never told her about the day I cursed God to see if he would kill me. It was storming hard, thunder and lightning, and Mama had just whipped me for taking a sip of the church wine. I looked up and said, "Go on, God. Go on and kill me if you're there." Repeated it over and over. Nothing happened. So I yelled the first curses of my life. Motherfucker. Son of a bitch. Jesus Christ. Blasphemed till I was hoarse. So then I began to doubt God because he didn't kill me. I'm saying, "You flunked the test. You're not up there." But I was still thinking, "He's somewhere." Elmer Gerard Pratt was born in the shotgun cottage of Death Alley on September 13, 1947, the couple's eighth and last child. One son died. Eunice wanted to name the baby after Saints Francis and Gerard, but her oldest son Charles protested that Francis sounded too feminine. Throughout his childhood, the boy was called Gerard, except when his mother summoned him off the street with a pungent "Elmer G," that some said could capsize a shrimper in the Gulf. The four sons, Charles, Gerard, Timothy, and Jackie, shared one lumpy bed. The three sisters slept together in the next room, and the parents in the alley front room. At night, the boys would sneak into the yard, listen to the cicadas, and check to see if the moon was holding ring. They fell asleep to the chuff of tugboats herding barges on the intercoastal waterway. Their father said that one of those diesel boats could push Avoca Island all the way to Key West. Helicopters chattered constantly, hauling oil rig supplies and personnel. An hour or so after midnight in the Southern Pacific's train number one, the Sunset Limited rattled windows as it rumbled west on its single track two blocks from the Pratt House. With 15,000 inhabitants, Morgan City was only a flag stop for the Great Express. Every morning, the family awoke to the bells of the nearby Sacred Heart Church, where their color made them unwelcome. Geronimo recalled his family's church of choice, Holy Eucharist. Father John Hartman was our priest, a white Josephite from Brooklyn. The Josephites were the church's shock troops working in the social jungles. He preached love, and we gave it right back. At night, he put on an eye shade and played poker. At one mass, he noticed some poor whites sitting in one corner and said, "I want you all to move up and sit with the rest of us." That was the first act of public integration in Morgan City. After a typical breakfast of beef liver, grits, and milk, the children attended their all-black grammar school and then repaired to the hot ashes and scorched rats of the dump. At home, Eunice Pratt continued their educations. Mama recited as she was doing the ironing. Geronimo's sister, Jacqueline, recalled, "Over the hill to the poorhouse, Noah built the ark. She made us recite Shakespeare, Plato, Longfellow, Confucius. We read African-American writers Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, Willard Motley. We put on plays in the kitchen. Mama wrote and produced, had us memorizing all the time. Wouldn't let us split a verb. By the time we grew up, we barely had our Southern accents." Context of White Supremacy, that is audio segment one. We will resume. We are still in chapter two of Last Man Standing. The number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. Email untiljustice@gmail.com if you have a written commentary. As I said, this is our follow for O.J. Simpson. I don't think I can even confess at one point I was a little disgruntled, like, wow, like Geronimo Pratt, like I would say far fewer folks are aware of Geronimo Pratt and his case and everything and Johnny Cochran representing him than O.J. Simpson. I was disgruntled, like I didn't follow the O.J. Simpson case, but I read this book way before the cows existed and was amazed. We're still, you know, we haven't even completed chapter two, so we'll get lots more information. It's been a while since I read this book, but my recollection, this book has lots of information about COINTELPRO and the Black Panther Party in general. Once we get to the thrust of Mr. Pratt being in the party and how he came to be accused of these crimes, lots of information about the COINTELPRO program, footnotes all along the way, like very detailed source of information, and obviously about this case in particular and Johnny Cochran's involvement. And this is such a great follow to hear these two in succession. It will boomerang, will go complete full circle, and I mean all the way, because this case lasted 25 years. So this is a much longer narrative than the O.J. Simpson case, even though that one is, you know, chock full of adventure for about a year and a half. This is 25 years of, you know, COINTELPRO and lying and blah, 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 and all of this and going back to court and everything else and trying to get information. So we eventually will boomerang all the way back to, oh, wow, look at that, O.J. Simpson. And what do you mean police don't make up and convict black people of crimes that they didn't do while Geronimo Pratt is watching all of this and Johnny Cochran being the attorney and then Johnny Cochran doing all that work in the O.J. Simpson case and then coming right back to get Geronimo Pratt as well. He even concludes his book. I said that last week. He's got O.J. Simpson. They're free. And he says, got to do this with Geronimo Pratt. And they did about a year and a half later. It is absolutely incredible. And I said yesterday, it is amazing. O.J. Simpson's mother, Eunice Simpson. Geronimo Pratt's mother, Eunice Pratt. Both O.J. and Geronimo born in 1947. In fact, they are born weeks apart. And it just goes on and on and on. Both falsely accused of murder, the LAPD. In fact, I said this last week, some of the exact same names you'll have to remember. You will have to have a bit of a memory. By the time we get, you know, deep into this case, some of the exact same white people who were involved in the prosecution of O.J. Simpson will eventually be involved in this case. So it is amazing. Like, this should be study session. This, I think, is going to be our best 1-2 for the book club that I would probably not even, you know, I guess Johnny Cochran, that's pretty easy. Should be an easy connect, Johnny Cochran, but I mean, wow, incredible similarities that will just keep coming between these two. And even think about that, for a black male marries a white woman, sexual intercourse with white women, nothing to do with racism, not talking about racism or anything like that. I just play football and entertain white people. And then you got a black guy who's a Vietnam veteran, two tours, joins the Black Panther Party, all that rhetoric, off the pig, all the rest. And they both end up in the exact same spot, greater confinement, accused of killing white people under suspicious circumstances. Blackmail privilege, put it that way. Blackmail privilege. Let's see. Was there anything I was going to read? We can hit the Hit the phone lines. I guess we can hit the phone lines. There's more I will be able to read from Johnny Cochran's text. I started with the preface from his book on that one. He has lots more information in his book about the Geronimo Pratt case, but that'll have to wait until we actually get to, again, the crimes that he was charged of. Oh, that was the other thing. Man, the O.J. Simpson overlap is amazing. So I watched, this is my wheelhouse. I said this earlier. This is the type of information I was researching before there was a cows. I was studying the so-called civil rights movement and COINTELPRO. This type, that's why I've read this book years before the cows existed and books like this. So I was very, very primed when counter-racism, like, oh, it's just different languaging and that sort of thing. But this is what I was looking at. So I should have lots of sources for, oh, check this out. So I'm trying to go back and jog my memory and think about different aspects. We've even done some programs talking about Geronimo Pratt before. One of them, All Power to the People, documentary film. It's great. It's about the Black Panthers, Malcolm X, lots of folks. Within that documentary, they begin talking about, they actually interviewed Geronimo Pratt. And they're talking about his case, falsely accused. He was still in greater confinement at the time. And so they pause and they go to Donald Freed. And they're talking about the depths of the, or he is talking about the COINTELPRO program. And we didn't know how diverse it was and the depths of the program and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, Donald Freed? Donald Freed? And I had to pause because this video is like 25 years old. It might even be older than that at this point, but it's kind of old. So I'm paused like, wait a minute. And I'm looking like, Donald Freed, that's the Donald Freed who wrote Killing Time. Like, that's the book that is about the O.J. Simpson murder, where he's saying that this is total nonsense and it focuses on the timeline, which I said last week, if you need three things that O.J. Simpson didn't do it, bang, timeline. That's one. Donald Freed wrote a whole book about that, and he's done interviews like, this is ridiculous and blah, blah, blah. And he doesn't say racist, but I mean, this is absolutely absurd. This is a total cover up. It does not make sense. And he goes through a lot of that in his book, Killing Time, which I have and just been reading. And then I didn't even know, like, I've seen this documentary before, but I didn't, the name Donald Freed didn't mean anything to me. So watching it this time, like, oh, wow, like the overlap is amazing between these two cases on so many levels. We'll be able to point that out as we move along. But Donald Freed as well, he's still alive, has a website where he talks about the OJ case, a little bit of COINTELPRO as well. Anywho, the number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943. Pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Make sure I'm not remiss. I said it yesterday, but March 3, that was yesterday, 30 years to the date of the Rodney King beating. We heard a lot about Rodney King over the O.J. Simpson book read. My suspicion is that Rodney King is going to pop up again way down the line in the book. That's just a guess. I have to see. I know OJ is going to come up. I remember that. But I think Rodney King is probably going to boomerang way, way later in the book as well. But that was this week. I thought that was appropriate just because there have been so many mentions in our book reading. 30 years to the date of the video recorded beating, LAPD terrorism on so many levels. Rodney King, and they had a lot of reports in the LA Times. They had sketches from the court trial and other components. Just feels we have been talking about Rodney King indirectly a lot over the past few months, and 30 years to the date yesterday. Alrighty, folks who dialed in, if you have thoughts on the first portion of the reading, Jack Olson's Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. If you have a thought or two, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry, in Chicago.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Not much in this reading, just a couple of things. I didn't understand on page 2 when he was talking about Jailhouse Annie's. I'm not sure if you know, Gus, or somebody else knows what a jailhouse ante is. I would love to hear, you know, what that metaphor is. Page three, where Hanlon basically kind of lies to the guard to get access to Mr. Pratt's to get access to Mr. Pratt, saying that he was an attorney. Obviously, you know, white people get the benefit of the doubt. You know, they can walk up and say, you know, they're an attorney, they're a doctor, they're a lawyer without flashing any credentials, and, you know, get the benefit of the doubt. So not surprised, you know, white men lying and just basically, you know, getting access to whatever he wants to. I thought the interaction on page seven was interesting when Hanlon and Pratt was, I guess, talking about their hair and their heritage, and, you know, Hanlon talking about he had a Jufro, and I thought that was kind of interesting with that. His the life of his father going into this next chapter. I thought when he talked about his father on page three, when he was describing his he was a great dancer, a ladies' man, and he was like, back when the Klan was active, he had his own gang. Whites asked his permission to cross the tracks. We had a reputation. Nobody messed with the guy from across the tracks. White folks call him Mr. Jack. I don't know, you know. I know we talk about, you know, whites not being scared of black people, but, you know, who knows? They did preference that he had, according to the quote, he had some European features and some Indian too. So, you know, maybe he was passing for white. I don't know. But he said a lot of European features, you know, so who knows? But yeah, he probably wasn't passing for white, but, you know, that was kind of interesting and strange in regards to his, you know, his father. But haven't looked at much about her. Well, they haven't said much about her mom, except that she was one of those who was a passant blanc, as described on page 15, where she was, I guess she could pass for white. So, you know, who knows? But I guess apparently they are non-white people, but they, you know, with them being in Louisiana, they could be, you know, because, you know, obviously in that area of the region, there was a lot of cowbells going on in that state. So, that's all I have on my mind.
Much obliged, Henry, in Chicago. Great point about being able to, if you are classified as white, you might not have to produce credentials. You can just lie. In fact, we just heard that from Jeff Toobin. I think that was how he snuck into Robert Shapiro's office. He was able to lie to his secretary and something else when he didn't have an appointment and all the rest of it. As for Jailhouse Annie's, I searched as you were sharing, and the first time that I searched for Jailhouse Annie's, I only got a limited number of search results, and most of them related to this book. So it doesn't seem to be a term that's in common use. The context for listeners, again, is Hanlon rode a bench outside the San Quentin visiting room for 2 hours while chattering. Jailhouse Annie's fussed at the admitting officers. At 11 a.m., he was ushered into the narrow visiting room for prisoners. So it seems like it could be folks who are there to visit. It seems like it actually could just be kind of a euphemism that he made up. Olson, the author, made up in this text, because it's not tons of uses popping up as though this is a common usage phrase. So that's what I think it means, just a term that he made up to describe other folks who are probably non-white people who are waiting there in the visiting room, as he said, chattering and fussing at the admitting officers while they wait to see probably some black males. That'd be my guess. If other folks have a guess about Jailhouse Annie's, please let us know. But that's my guess for the time being. Let's see. Much obliged, Henry, in Chicago. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Okay. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. There were several coincidences in the first reading. Interesting. It mentioned not directly, but indirectly, they was talking about Jonathan Jackson and its relationship to George Jackson. Jonathan Jackson was George Jackson's little brother. They mentioned about the Marion County courtroom. That was the same place that Jonathan went in fully armed and captured the judge and several other officials, and also freed three members who were with George Jackson inside the prison. George wasn't at the courtroom at the time. It didn't go well because he was killed. Actually, the police was violating their own procedures in the process of killing him. Moving on, I heard the name Huey P. Long. That is the exact person that Huey P. Newton, who's also was born in Louisiana, was named after. His father decided to name Huey P. Newton after this white male. I think he was either the governor of Louisiana or some political official. I can't exactly remember exactly who he was exactly. There's other Black Panther Party members who were born in Louisiana. David Hilliard, who also was the chief of staff of the Black Panther Party. I was just thinking about some memories of my own when they were mentioning about the area where Black people were staying at that time. It reminded me of some places down here in South Florida back when I was growing up in the late 50s, early 60s as a small child with the term shotgun shack. And the places were right in the middle of trains and all other type of things and whatnot, and one would be surprised if people get used to and sleep and actually get sleep, probably not correct sleep, with all of that going on in and around. The most undesirable place is where non-white Black people would be forced to stay at. And that's all I have to say about the first reading. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Lots of overlap. Huey P. Newton, as mentioned, named after former Governor Huey Long. Even Johnny Cochran's family from the Louisiana area as well. I think Mo and Dallas spoke up simultaneously. Did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, I do. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Jailhouse Annie's, I missed. It didn't catch my attention during the reading, but in context, it may apply to jailhouse anecdotes. That's just a guess. A couple of things stuck out to me during the reading. The first thing I wrote down was Jufro, It struck me because, in one sense, the Arthur was referring to the non-black white male, Jewish Irish male, and he was self-conscious of his hair, I guess, to some capacity, but it did not his appearance didn't keep him from lying. After I wrote Jufro, I wrote, you know, his quote, "I'm his attorney," and he said, "That's almost true," which which was a lie. He was not an attorney. I think he was a law student. And I also noted that it was just assumed that he was an attorney. He didn't have to justify that with any credentials. I thought that was common. And even though it's common, it's just like, really, you're going to let this person have access to a prisoner without questioning his credentials? I mean, his word was good enough. Another quote, his milk chocolate skin seemed to glow with intensity. I just thought of the Delectable Negro. Like that stuck out to me. And it inspired me to look up, the author, which is a white male. I don't know why, but that just stuck out. That's all I have for now. Mute my line.
Much obliged. Mo in Dallas, Delectable Negro reference. Indeed. I don't think that's something that should be minimized, the ease with which white people are able to lie and or not provide evidence, credentials, and go wherever they please, question whomever they want, so-called lockdown of secure facilities, like being classified as white and lying. Whew, amazing ability, power. It's almost like a superpower to be white and being able to lie. Like, just, it's amazing. Other folks that we've missed totally.
When I was listening, I thought that Hanlon, I think he knew more about Geronimo Pratt than he was saying. I think he made it seem like he didn't know much about him and whatnot. And I think he knew more, and that was the reason that he was interested. It seems like I haven't read the book, and I don't really know much about it, but from what I've just read, it just seemed like that to me. And then, what else? I guess I just didn't like the fact that it started off with this Hanlon person, the white person, or I don't know, maybe he's not white. I also noticed the term Jew was used a lot. The fact that he could lie, and then he was described as, I guess, his college grad, like, colleagues described him as a pig pen. So, I mean, it sounds like as if he wasn't, in appearance-wise, taking care of himself properly or something, but he was still afforded, I guess, white supremacist rights, I guess, I don't know. I also thought that the section that said that Geronimo's father, that white people asked him to come to that section of town, it sounded exaggerated, maybe. But it did sound like as if he did attempt counter violence, and I do appreciate that in the first reading, like the gentleman, Alonzo Brown. I guess so far we have like two examples of like black male counter violence. So that's good. And then I didn't like the part where it sounded like Johnny Cochran was asking for Hanlon's help. Like, it was a little bit off-putting to me. I'm not sure why. And then Geronimo Pratt's appearance, like, I guess Hanlon tries to make him seem as if he's non-black, as if he's some other. He even names, I think, I can't remember, some other. I think I've seen that term, as if it's like, I don't know, like a Middle Eastern tribe or something. I can't remember the term that he used. But the images that I've seen of Geronimo Pratt, I just thought he was just black. Maybe I've seen the incorrect images. Thank you.
Agreed. I've seen a number of pictures of Geronimo Pratt, and I just thought he was a black person, but he gives a lot, like he, at one point he says, a light-skinned African-American shuffled forward in Fu Manchu half-steps, that's kind of starting there, and then he has another section where he goes into more detail with the same. I felt like it happens a number of times where both Geronimo Pratt and then when he's talking about his parents, where it's lots of terms to distance them from just being, these are just black people, like that they could pass. And then the Creole term to describe his mom in particular, like I thought that was quite emphasized for all of the black people. I have to flip through and see if I can find some of the other spots where they talk about the complexion. He used descriptors for Geronimo Pratt. Let me double check. Are there any folks we missed totally? Folks, double check. I'll go through and read a few of my notes, probably find the section I was talking about in the meantime. Let's see. The book starts with the chapter from Isaiah. Isaiah, and then chapter 59, verse 14. Johnny Cochran was quoting Isaiah in his preface, introduction to Journey to Justice as well. I thought Hanlon talking about how his hair, all the emphasis on his hair and having a Jufro and all the rest of it, and saying that they called him Pigpen. Again, it didn't seem like there was any serious penalty. He's still an attorney or moving through to be an attorney and all the rest of it. So it didn't seem like he incurred a penalty. As with non-white people, if they say you're unkempt and don't have it together, that might be reason to have you classified as a juvenile delinquent. Like that'll be the reason that you don't get into law school or something of that effect. I think Pigpen is still classified as white, name or no. All of this around the Jufro and all the rest of it. Jew is not a racial classification. We have had individuals who are classified as black on the program who also say that they are Jewish. You can marry and then be reclassified as so-called Jewish. You cannot do that with your racial classification. That causes a lot of confusion for folks. Him even presenting and saying that I'm half Jewish. What does that mean? Like, what are you even talking about? All the, are you white? That's we get back. White? Non-white. Cut out all that confusion. Man, the only reason we're reading this book right now, Jeffrey Toobin masturbating on Zoom. That's why we read the O.J. Simpson book. This was the follow. I said that as soon as we started the O.J. Simpson book, like, oh yeah, this is the follow. Johnny Cochran, let's just follow more of his career. The Dalton School is mentioned where, give the full paragraph, Hanlon was unprepared for Pratt's story. The law student was a semi-hippified, whatever that means, product of a middle-class home, a graduate of the Riverside Country Day School for Boys. You think about that with all of the school closures that we just talked about, where you have these exclusive schools for white children, where you have illiterate black people who can't, like, isn't that what they said about O.J. Simpson? Illiterate, semi-literate black male? Anyway, who grew up in California. Anyway. He was a son of a gentle housewife who was descended from Russian Jews and a placid Irish Catholic father who taught math and English at the Dalton School for Girls in Manhattan. Placid, I generally think, meaning melanin deficient, really pale. Taught math and English at the Dalton School for Girls in Manhattan. The only reason the Dalton School for Girls in Manhattan means anything to me at all, Jeffrey Epstein. Who? Wait a minute. Jeffrey Epstein lied about his credentials so he could teach at the Dalton School. For people who don't know, Jeffrey Epstein, now deceased, accused, convicted, sexual abuser, accused of raping many white children all over the world for a number of years. Alan Dershowitz, who was on the O.J. Simpson defense team, was also one of the defense lawyers for Jeffrey Epstein, and was later accused of the same crimes and being involved in all of the sex trafficking of children and all the rest of it. But that's the only reason that I know about the Dalton School is because of Jeffrey Epstein. So again, Jeff Toobin, Jeffrey Epstein. I even said that in the last book, Bill Hodgman. He is known. Yeah, he was on the losing team for the OJ, but he did a lot of work subsequently with the sexual abuse scandals of children. So all of that to say, again, white people do not care about children, and you'll probably see that repeated over and over, even as we move through this text. Let's see. Milk chocolate skin, I thought was important. All of the descriptors, I guess we can pay attention to that, the way in terms of, oh yeah, because it's all together. So it's all within about the same two paragraphs where we get this description of Geronimo Pratt as having milk chocolate skin, delectable Negro, and his mispronunciation of these white philosophers. See, Negroes aren't as smart as they think. And then he comes down and he talks about his rippling muscles. That's kind of delectable Negro too, a little bit maybe. And then he says, Hanlon thought there was a Yul Brynnerish cast to his features, a Eurasian, that was it for the black African, a Eurasian touch. What does that mean? Or was it Byzantine? He thought, how silly that we call this man black or Negro or colored. Pratt was hybrid. His nose was on the thin side and slightly turned up at the tip, like Hanlon's, a white man. His dark brownish hair was finely textured. He saw Hanlon studying his hairline. He said, down home we call this white man hair. I always wanted a big woolly bully. I even thought that word was interesting. Woolly bully, because I generally just hear people say woolly, but then they said woolly bully, and I guess I'm attuned to that because I was accused of bullying a white woman on the program last week. It's always something violent. We got man, and we just heard the black female, Miss Castle, she did the podcast in Southern California last week. She talked about her work at KCRW where they said she had militaristic hair. And now we got a woolly bully afro. I'm just saying, I've never heard that term used to describe black hair. Bully. Can we just say woolly hair and leave it at that? Anyway, woolly bully hair, woolly bully afro. But my longest was an inch or two. My daddy's hair was straight. It's our blood, Irish, African, French, Cajun, Indian. And then we get to the half Jewish and all that. But yeah, we'll have to pay a lot. All of that is fascinating. I would say all of that is just the system of white supremacy, racism. And generally, it can't just be that a black person is attractive, especially if they have melanin. Rich black person is just attractive. It's got, oh, this black person is attractive because they have features that are closer to that of a white person. They have white hair or a white nose, or they're not too dark, or they're kind of Eurasian or Kablan Asian and all the rest of it. Something other than just the crystal black person. Continuing. Yes, I think retired firefighter did fantastic job recounting. They were discussing, talking about Jonathan Jackson and George Jackson, who was mentioned just yesterday with the white woman. She was talking about books to recommend, and she ran right down the list, Blood in My Eye and Soledad Brother and all the rest of it. I guess some of this will probably come up again when we get to Geronimo Pratt and him joining the Black Panther Party. We'll probably hear some of these names down the road. Let's see. The conversation when Hanlon goes to talk to Johnny Cochran and he says this is all reversed. Johnny Cochran's in a Rolls Royce. Some things have not changed. It seems Johnny Cochran was still driving nice cars, nice life, even at the O.J. Simpson trial. He says everything is reversed. The black guy's got the Rolls Royce and I'm the broke person, I guess, understanding typically the system of white supremacy, we would expect it to be the other way around. But he continues and he says, so this guy didn't do it. Geronimo Pratt, he's innocent. He's asking Johnny Cochran. Johnny Cochran's like, oh, yeah, Didn't do it. No question at all. This guy's a victim of a frame-up that goes so high, it's scary. I wouldn't be surprised if the FBI was involved. They are and how. What's the proof? That's the problem. That's the exact same thing they said in the O.J. Simpson case. What proof do you have that Mark Furman planted this glove or whatever else, that he doesn't like niggers like O.J. Simpson? What proof do you have, knowing it's really hard, generally speaking, to get proof that a white person practiced racism, and especially that a police officer practiced racism or did something nefarious, untoward, to convict, target a black person? Let's see. Yeah, I think talking about his parents, I think there might be some hyperbole. I know there were many, many black people who did. There were many, many black people who did engage in self-defense and counter violence as they could. But white people in Louisiana being afraid to go into an area where non-white people reside, I'm not sure. They might. I am aware that sometimes black people were not as terrorized. I'll say it that way, that sometimes if a black person had some self-respect about themselves, that they might not be treated as badly as some of the other black people. White people might be a little bit more courteous or more professional in dealing with them from time to time. I am aware that that did happen, but I don't know how much that expended. There still is an army behind the system of white supremacy that I don't care how much black self-respect and all the rest you think you have, you don't have. Let's see. The improvisation I thought was important. Geronimo Pratt talking about his dad being able to fix things, and even though he didn't have tools and what have you, being able to change the brakes on the car and all the rest of it, just extraordinary. Compensation, I think one might call that, compensatory, making up for what you do not have. Let's see. I think we would at least have some evidence of not a deadbeat dad, him getting up and going out to work and work with his sons and showing them how to do things. Not a deadbeat, down and out, no count black father. Let's see. Yeah, and we have, like, comes back again. He says, the trash picker was idolized by seven children. He was a street corner kid. Geronimo remembered he was the wretched of the earth, Frantz Fanon. Raised in Storyville in New Orleans and the back streets of Morgan City. That's formerly the worst book I ever read. Forget it's been so long. I'm not saying that with any reverence. I'm just pointing out Wretched of the Earth. That's Frantz Fanon, formerly the worst book I ever read. A lot of European features and some Indian too. Comes up over, well, we'll have to see how often that comes up in the book. A black person who's attractive or described in that way, and then some features that are associated with white people. And then white people called him Mr. Jack. I've heard that before, more courtesy or less terrorism than we would dole out to other black people. Their area being called Across the Tracks reminded me of sundown towns again. Coon Mountain and Niggerville, we've heard these type of descriptors used before. Anything else to make sure get in? Yeah, I think I'm willing to stop there. We have a nice chunk where they'll get into more information about what led Geronimo Pratt to join the Black Panther Party to begin with. So I'll pause there. If other folks have thoughts that they would like to share, just make a note and we'll have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. So we are still in chapter two, getting more information about the early years of Geronimo Jijaga Pratt. We will hear what were the motivations for him to become a Vietnam veteran and for him to join the Black Panther Party as we continue. Jack Olson, Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt, audio segment two. Race had seldom been an issue in Morgan City, perhaps because there had been so much interracial coupling that many of the white residents were related to passants blancs or were passing themselves. On pain of harsh punishment, none of the Pratt children used racial pejoratives, even in the most violent disagreements. In prison, where words like nigger and redneck were in common currency, Geronimo Pratt avoided them and counseled others to do the same. "I wasn't brought up that-a-way," he explained. "Mama gave us the good side of the Germans, the Jewish people, the Scottish, the Irish, everybody. Mama said, always remember, the black folks didn't end slavery, whites did. She said, read your Bible about the white martyrs. I asked her what color was Mr. Shakespeare. She said Mr. Shakespeare was human color." Racial violence was rare. When Geronimo was 9 or 10, he and a classmate were swimming at the point where the tidal surge and the river met in rips. A group of white boys threw rocks, and the classmate was hit in the forehead. 3 days later, little Geronimo watched in shock as a fisherman unraveled the body from his trout line. He was a very dark boy, almost black, but the crabs nibbled off his skin and turned him bluish white. River shrimp stuck to his fingertips. The skin on his stomach was so thin you could see his insides. It was a terrible, terrible thing, but we didn't think of it as racial. We just thought it was cruel. It couldn't been black kids that threw those rocks. That's the way we saw things. Eunice Petty Pratt was aware of the pressures that had shaped her husband's attitudes about sex and race, but she kept the information from her children till he was gone. Then she told them, "Your daddy cooked on paddle wheel workboats, but he quit when he saw how the crew disrespected black women." Older brother Jackie Pratt pried out the details and related them later. "One day, Daddy came out the galley as his boat was getting ready to dock. One of the white guys was mouthing off about splitting a black oak, changing his luck, trash like that. The black whorehouse was a blight on our neighborhood just a few blocks from our house. Daddy came up on deck with a cleaver and said, 'Look, you're gonna stop talking like that about black women. I'm married to a black woman. You don't hear me saying nothing about white women, do you?'" Here's a little guy, 5'7", 140 pounds, standing up to that whole crew. When they docked, Daddy collected his pay and quit. That's what made him an independent drayman. He taught us kids not to take anybody's crap. Mama always reminded us, that's the kind of man raised you up. That's why not a one of you can see injustice and not do something about it. Thank your daddy for that. On the muggy day after Palm Sunday in 1960, 12-year-old Geronimo Pratt was walking home from Mass with his mother, brother Tim, and sister Imelda. Sister Jacqueline, the organist, was still in church rehearsing the next day's music. The three other Pratt children had gone west, Charles to graduate from UCLA and work with computers, Jackie to enroll at California State University at Los Angeles, and Sister Virginia, an honors graduate at Southern University, to teach in the LA ghettos. Eunice was the first to spot Jack Pratt lying on his side near the chicken coop. A split bag of dried corn lay by his outstretched hand. Chickens clucked around his body. She dropped her missile, lifted him into a sitting position, and then lowered him. "Imelda," she said in a soft voice, "call the ambulance." The sight of their omnipotent father lying among the chickens was more than his sons could comprehend. Geronimo stood frozen, and Tim slowly shook his head. "Timothy," the mother said, still speaking calmly, "get some salt." Geronimo helped his mother arrange the drayman on his back and watched as she sprinkled salt into his mouth till he gulped and began to breathe. Then they formed a circle around his body and prayed. The stricken man was driven to a Morgan City clinic in a hearse that also served the African American community as an ambulance. A doctor told Eunice, "He's had a very severe stroke. His chances are minimal. He'll have to go to Charity Hospital." Eunice arranged herself in the back of the hearse for the 3-hour drive to New Orleans. Before she pulled the rear door shut, she instructed her children, "Pray your rosaries." Charles, Jackie, and Virginia Pratt arrived on the first plane from Los Angeles to join in the vigil. Their father lay in a public ward with a dozen other patients, most of them terminal. For days, he neither moved nor spoke. His children sat in upright chairs, their beads clicking through their fingers. Almost every night a patient died, and the brothers helped to wrap the bodies and deliver them by gurney to the hospital morgue. One morning, Jackie was awakened as an old man fell dead across his knees. Jack Pratt was pronounced dead 3 times. Then, one day, he began to mumble, but not even Eunice could understand him. After a few months, he was returned to Across the Tracks in the same hearse. Under his wife's care, he began to walk with a crutch, dragging a leg, one arm limp. He learned to say a few words. He sat in the sun on the weather-beaten back porch and stared at his loquat tree, his anvil, and leftover collection of junk. One day he hobbled a few feet toward the river. The next day he walked farther, and the family members offered thanks for answered prayers. Then a neighborhood boy laughed at him, and he took a seat in the parlor and never walked again. The Pratts of Morgan City were now a matriarchy. The immediate problem was money. The junkman had made his share but handed out more. All 7 children were college-bound or had matriculated, and their parents were approaching 60. The house was sagging, the porous roof had barely withstood the last hurricane, and Jack Pratt and Sons was defunct. Timothy and Geronimo scrounged lumber and cinder blocks to erect a bungalow for their parents on an adjacent plot. Virginia helped with the financing. "We didn't know masonry or carpentry," Geronimo recalled. "All we knew was to make the sides higher and higher. Redid the roof 4 times before we got it right. Took us 3 years, but it'll stand a long time. There's a statue of the Virgin in front and a rose bush behind." After school, he scrounged for cash. "I shot rabbits and coons and sold the meat. That's how I bought Mama a nice hat for Christmas and my first pair of leather shoes. I got $2 for coons, $1.50 for rabbits. I sold Nutria pellets and the gator's meat. My daddy'd taught me to jump on backs and thump 'em hard in the throat." Instead of burning their fingertips at the dump, the Pratt children chilled them at Mr. Ben's freezer at the end of Arkansas Street. Mr. Ben blew his siren when boats came in to unload, and everybody'd go running to get in line and head up the swimp. That's what they're called in Morgan City, swimp. Channel catfish swam under the docks. It was nothing to catch a dozen on a hand line. I'd skin 'em and sell 'em to the white people across the tracks, a nickel a fish, 10 cents cleaned. As he entered his teens, Geronimo refused to cross to the other side of the street when he saw white girls approaching, but he tried not to give offense by ogling them or making remarks. It seemed to him that most whites acted the same. He considered it showing mutual respect. He was aghast when a summertime friend, son of a migratory fisherman, said hi
to a 14-year-old white neighbor while playing football on the levee with Geronimo and his brother Tim. The white girl threw them a hard look and ran off. Geronimo knocked the offender flat and said, "Man, we don't do that here." The boy said, "I didn't do nothing wrong." "Listen, man, we got this agreement in our neighborhood. We don't disrespect whites, and they don't disrespect us. You're out of line, man." An hour later, Geronimo and Tim were playing in their backyard when the girl's father barged into their house and screamed racial epithets at their father in his wheelchair. Police arrived, handcuffed the brothers, and took them to the station. The white father and daughter berated the Pratt boys at the booking desk. "Hold on," Geronimo said. "Please, my brother and I didn't do nothing." "You whistled at my daughter," the man said. "She say that?" The girl nodded and pointed at Timothy. "If you say that about my brother," Geronimo said, "you're a damn liar." The father cocked his arm and a policeman intervened. Timothy spoke up. "What's me and Gerard charged with?" He was remembering something his sister Virginia had told him. "Slavery isn't dead, Tim. It's just changed form." "Assault," the booking sergeant replied. "For playing on the levee?" "For whistling at a white girl, making smart remarks." Timothy asked what charges would be brought against her father. "He ran through our house without knocking, disturbed my daddy in his wheelchair. I believe that is called trespassing." The cop locked the young malefactors in a cell next to the canine kennel. All night long, Tim sat on the hard bench and prayed, his first instinct in times of trouble. Geronimo was more puzzled than angry. "Imagine that," he muttered to his brother. "We didn't say a word and we end up in jail. Imagine that." He still blamed the fisherman's son. The brothers were released in the morning after the police chief checked the booking sheet and learned that his cells were holding two of his friend Jack Pratt's offspring. He chauffeured the boys home in his personal car. Eunice Pratt walked to the complaining girl's house and warned her father that the next time he entered the family residence without knocking, he would be met by something a little stronger than 1 Corinthians. Discussing the painful memory later, Geronimo explained, "I didn't blame the police, I blamed the other boy. That's the way I was conditioned. Going to jail was a learning experience, but I didn't learn nothing from it. Color consciousness crept up on me and the other kids. We knew nothing about black rage and wouldn't have understood a concept like that." "Black rage? About what?" "We were happy. No kids ever got more out of life. Respected ourselves, our family, our neighbors, got along, worked and played. Until the Klan hurt Timothy, then everything changed." It was a Halloween night, and Geronimo Pratt was Lafitte the pirate. We were trick-or-treating on the other side of the tracks. Me, Tim, my buddy Kadu Delco. We didn't know that black kids had jumped some white kids and taken their candy a few blocks away. A Klan family started a search and destroy. When their car drove up on us, we started running. I jumped a ditch and heard screams behind me. They caught Tim. I knew I had to go back and help my brother, but I was scared. So I went back in slow motion. He stopped to rub his eyes. "Still bothers me after all these years what I didn't do." Tim was on the ground being beaten up, and I was shaking like a baby.
I knew I could reach my brother faster, but I was 15. The closer I got, the louder Tim screamed. They were pounding his head on the street. Nigger this and nigger that. I recognized the white man, his grown sons, and another big white dude. My daddy always told us they were a Klan family. I pulled out my costume knife, an ugly plastic thing I found on the dock. Then I heard this womp, womp, footsteps pounding up behind me. It was my big brother Jackie. He knocked my knife into the gutter and kept right on running toward Tim. Neither him nor Daddy ever backed down for nothing. Right behind Jackie came big boy Pac, Kato, then my sister Imelda and Mama. My sister Virginia finally caught up to the rest of us. She was waving one of Daddy's 44s with two hands. Jenny was the Harriet Tubman of our family. She stopped and took dead aim, and the next thing we saw was dust and taillights. Tim was out cold. Mama put her ear to his mouth and cradled his head. When she stood up, I saw a line of blood down the front of her dress. It was a long time till the hearse came to take my brother to the hospital. Timothy Pratt appeared normal when he returned home, but soon epileptic seizures began, first every few weeks, then more often. At school, where he'd been a leader, he suffered violent headaches and frequently had to be excused from class. My brother made a full recovery, earned a master's degree, and became a successful teacher, Geronimo recalled, but it took him years to get over what the Klan did to him. His last couple years in high school, he was a big, handsome guy with no confidence at all. Shy around girls, he knew he might fall down any minute and bite his tongue till it bled. A couple of times when he knelt in church alongside the priest, Tim jumped up and started sprinkling holy water without realizing what he was doing. Once he took the censer, so golden and beautiful, and wandered around the church with it. Mama would stop him. People would watch. We had to be so patient. Later, he had no memory of what he did. I loved my brother, and he was a constant reminder to me about cruelty and injustice. For a while, I was obsessed with getting even, but how does a kid fight the whole damn Ku Klux Klan? The night they beat up Timothy, Elmer Gerard Pratt moved to another plane. I didn't stay enraged. I didn't even stay bitter. But I became aware. At Morgan City Colored High, Geronimo found a temporary outlet in football. His siblings had distinguished themselves as honor students, choral members, and cheerleaders. Geronimo was a sophomore when the football coach saw the boy launch a pass that traveled 50 yards. Soon, the baby of the Pratt family was starting at quarterback. We played Franklin Colored High, Thibodeau Colored High, every colored high in South Louisiana. We didn't mind being called colored. That's what we were. Pratt graduated in 1965 with a B average, a full grade below his studious older brothers and sisters, and entertained feelers for football scholarships to Southern University, alma mater of his brother Tim and sisters Jacqueline and Virginia, and to Grambling University. But the African-American elders of Morgan City had other ideas. In my teens, I heard these guys talking down at Mr. Jimmy's barbershop or late at night on our porch or hanging outside the Kick-Em-Out bar, Geronimo recalled years later. I didn't pay much attention. Everybody called them the elders, and they set the tone in across the tracks. They talk about black people being killed and thrown in the river, sent to Angola penitentiary for raping white women that they hadn't even touched, uppity niggers being tarred and feathered and run out of town. The men known as elders included the barber Harris, the retiree Joe Ruffin, who liked to say, "I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees," a bootblack named Bud Dudley, who wore a suit and passed out candy, and solid citizens Geronimo knew only as Mr. Aloysius, Mr. Campbell, Mr. Chim, Mr. Forrest, and Mr. Valentine. The elders never came right out and told you what to do, but they advised strongly. You wouldn't dream of going against them. If I was about to do something stupid, Mr. Joe Ruffin would whoop me, then deliver me to Mama for another whooping. Our whole neighborhood ran like that. We had no police protection. Our cops were the elders. When they settled a dispute, it was settled. They made us say, "Yes, sir," "No, sir," taught us manners and common sense. We had reverence for the elders. In later years, when Geronimo found himself with unlimited time to study black history, he was able to trace the system of elders back to the 1920s and the revolutionary Marcus Garvey. He created a military protectorate called the Legionnaires that was so organized it would blow your mind. One of my uncles was a Legionnaire. They organized throughout the South. It was simple self-defense against the Klan that was burning churches, preaching hate. Before that, black people had always rallied behind our preachers, but they were old men living in the past. Loved everybody, shuffled off to City Hall with that hat in hand. "Yassa, Mr. Whitey." "No, sir." The Legionnaires were more like army troops. In Louisiana, they went under the names Deacons of Defense and Justice. They actively fought the Klan, but they were outnumbered, so they had to work quietly. You heard about all the churches burnt by the Klan, all the children burnt to death, but you never heard of some of the retaliations the Deacons did in return. A lot of Klan never knew what hit 'em. I was born into this tradition of militance and secrecy, but I stayed asleep for a long time. Our elders reached back to the Legionnaires in a straight line. They weren't just a bunch of old black dudes sitting around telling lies. They were our underground, our soul and backbone. Those who knew about 'em didn't say, and those who said didn't know. When the elders told you what to do, man, you did it. The day before high school graduation ceremonies, Geronimo Pratt and some of his friends received their marching orders. Right there in Mr. Jimmy's barbershop, the elders laid it out. Some of the things they told me I already knew, some I hadn't caught up with. I knew about Malcolm X being killed. I knew about Freedom Summer, when the three civil rights workers were murdered by the Klan in Mississippi. I knew about the marches and the murdered white preacher from Boston. I knew about the police using dogs and fire hoses on women and children. But I didn't know about the little girls incinerated in the church in Birmingham. I didn't know that the Klan killed a civil rights worker from Michigan for giving a ride to a black man. I didn't know about the Alabama state troopers that shot down Jimmie Lee Jackson, or the seminary student who was cut in half by double-aught buckshot from a white deputy sheriff in Alabama, or a whole bunch of other killings by the Klan and the cops. And he didn't know about the specific incident that had caused the alarmed elders to call the local blacks together. A few days earlier, Sheriff's deputies O'Neill Moore and David Creed Rogers had been driving on Route 21 in Washington Parish, a KKK stronghold north of Morgan City, when hooded men in a pickup truck opened fire. Moore died. Rogers lost an eye. Their offense appeared to be that they were among the first African American deputies to be commissioned in Louisiana. The Deacons for Defense and Justice immediately sent patrols to protect black citizens.
locals knew the identity of the killers, but the white leaders swore they would never be prosecuted. Wholesale killings were predicted. After the elders finished relating their horror story, Geronimo asked, "How come I never read nothing about that in the papers?" Mr. Jimmy Harris told him, "Son, there is a lot of things you didn't read about in the papers." Later, Geronimo recalled, "By the time the elders finished amping me up, I was ready to take on the whole KKK single-handed. I said, 'Tell me what to do.'" Mr. Elmo explained that the black community needed trained men to help protect our people. In the years after World War II and the Korean War, there had been a good supply of black veterans skilled in munitions, perimeter defense, sandbagging, riflery, hand-to-hand combat, stuff like that. But the older guys, like the Gurdies, Nanny Boo, Mr. Jimmy Harris himself, and some of the other elders, they were losing their zest. We had to develop a new generation of black warriors, or the Klan was going to overwhelm us. They were already overwhelming us. I knew if I went into the army, I'd be leaving Mama to cope with Daddy, but my sisters would help out, and so would everybody in the alley. Nobody was ever going to abandon Daddy. Our neighbors used to ask, "Can I push his wheelchair, Miss Eunice? Can I drive Mr. Jack to the store?" I planned to send my army paycheck home every month. Every penny I didn't need, I knew they'd get by. At 1 p.m. on the day after the meeting in the barber shop, Pratt entered the Greyhound station by the required side door to wait for the bus they called the Blue Dog. In a brown fiber suitcase salvaged from the dump, he carried his Bible, a change of underwear, and a toothbrush. He was on his way to the Army recruiting office in New Orleans. Back home, Eunice Petty Pratt tried to come to grips with her latest loss. Geronimo would be the first of her offspring to turn away from a college education, a troubling thought. In her dime store notebook, she printed the title of her entry in capital letters: "Mother, I am going to join the Army." How vividly do I recall these words, she continued in her neat Catholic schoolgirl penmanship. I looked into the corner at the chair where my baby sat. My baby joining the Army. I grieve over my baby. I thought, my little baby, a soldier. He slipped away quietly to catch the bus after insisting that I would not accompany him to the station. My heart went on with him as well as my prayers. "Oh God," I cried, "please help him. Go with him all the way. Help him to make a man of himself." Chapter 3. Soldier's Medal. At Fort Polk, Louisiana, the 17-year-old quarterback was issued dog tags, given shots, and a physical examination, and appointed trainee platoon sergeant. In Washington, President Lyndon Johnson was preparing to sign a Voting Rights Act. White supremacists were threatening to torch polling places and kill blacks. African American students at Cornell University were gearing up for armed insurrection. Geronimo's big brothers, Jackie and Charles, wrote from Los Angeles that the ghetto called Watts was afire in the Burn Baby Burn riots. Footnote number 7. 34 died, 1,000 were injured, and damage totaled $200 million. The Los Angeles Police Department crushed a series of student rebellions and engaged in a bloody battle with anti-Vietnam War demonstrators at the Century Plaza Hotel. Racial tension
was high, and many blamed it on black militants. Geronimo was in his second month of basic training when he learned that Timothy and Virginia were heading for the Los Angeles battle zones. Tim to observe and Jenny to resume her work with children. The trainee's first thought was of his mother. "Mama, I can't stop thinking about you all alone with Daddy," he wrote. "How can you do this by yourself? Oh, Mama, should I come home to help you?" Eunice wrote back that she was doing fine, but it was obvious that her youngest child was not. "You're homesick, just like every little boy who leaves his mama." Geronimo tried to overcome the dread illness by concentrating on guns, armor, reconnaissance, field tactics, and the skills that might help to protect his parents and the other black people of St. Mary Parish if race war finally broke out. 5 months after leaving Morgan City, he completed paratrooper training at Fort Benningen, Georgia, and pounded his wings into his bare chest. In those days, you did it to yourself. Man, the blood run. "The Army sent me to the 82nd Airborne Strike Troops. We were on orders for Vietnam." En route to the Far East, Geronimo was granted a 3-day pass in Los Angeles and called on his older brother Jackie, attending Cal State. He was up for anything, the older brother recalled years later. "Our country did a good job of preparing that young man for war." He said, "Man, I am ready." He wanted to save his country, the world, wanted to save his people back home. "I couldn't believe the change." 6 months after Pratt and his fellow troopers engaged in their first firefight in the Central Highlands, they were arrayed in a defensive perimeter around a group of battered tanks just off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. "We were barely dozing when we heard a chopper warming up to take off. Somebody started cussing. 'Goddamn son of a bitch, that fucking Chinook's gonna blow our fucking tents down.' I looked up. It was a medevac mission taking out our wounded. The chopper wasn't airborne for a minute when it flew straight into the side of Titty Mountain, 300 meters away. I ran through our perimeter, not even thinking. No rifle, no helmet, no brains. All I had was my radio. Those medevac guys were already wounded. They must be hurting bad. I went the last few yards, hand over hand, almost straight up. The chopper was broke in half and guys were screaming. The air was saturated with aviation gas and somebody down below was shooting off flares. I called in, 'Tell them fools to quit those flares. You're gonna fry us up here.' The helicopter's tail section was already ablaze." His citation read, "PFC Pratt, disregarding his own safety, entered the burning aircraft, aware of the possibility of enemy activity in the area and the likelihood of an explosion in the helicopter. PFC Pratt made repeated trips into the aircraft until all 5 occupants had been removed and taken a safe distance from the flaming wreckage. His heroic and selfless action at the risk of his own life is in keeping with the highest traditions of the military service and reflects great credit upon himself, his unit, and the United States of America." Geronimo was promoted to squad leader and awarded the Soldier's Medal, but before he had a chance to pin it on, he was wounded. "We were patrolling in jeeps, cleaning out pockets of VC in the Central Highlands. Sergeant Maddox was in the point vehicle, kicking ass as usual, and I was right behind. He was our protector, our John Wayne, a white guy from Arkansas with 14 years in. There was no racism around him. Anybody said the N-word, he'd have whooped their ass. We drove around some trees and I heard an explosion. the lead Jeep flew straight up in a cloud of smoke. The rest of us took cover, waiting for the ambush. After a while, we went forward and found Sergeant Maddox and two troopers. Between the three of them, there wasn't much left. The only whiteness left on Sergeant Maddox was around his eyes. I could see his brains. That killed me. I thought I would die from that sight. His skin looked like burnt toast. The ugliness of it, the indignity, I just couldn't understand. They medevaced the bodies out and we mounted up. Now I was on the point. I ordered the men to sandbag the floors of our jeeps in case we hit another landmine. 4 hours go by and all of a sudden I'm 10 feet in the air. I know I'm a basket case or I'm dead. One. I fell into a thick bush, shrapnel up my ass and my hips and thighs. My gunner and my driver had broken legs. I pulled them out and called in another medevac unit. The medics said the extra sandbags saved our lives. At the field hospital, they were going to drill a hole for a colostomy bag, but I took some Demerol and went back to my unit a few weeks later. I was more comfortable with my friends. It hurts me to think that some of them came home without arms or legs or their heads messed up, not much better off than Sergeant Maddox. White and black. Someday I want to go to the wall in Washington and say a prayer for his name, say a prayer for all of them. Before his 19th birthday, Pratt had made 64 combat jumps and was wearing the Purple Heart and the Air Medal. I did a lot of infiltration, long-range reconnaissance, night LPs, listening posts. I'd go out with a radio and a couple grenades and call in situation reports. I got so I almost enjoyed it, just me and the rats and Victor Charlie. In my first 12 months in NAM, there was hardly a day my unit wasn't in a firefight. One morning I woke up and found the guy in the next tent with his throat cut, a visit by the VC. It was a look at my future, but I didn't know it at the time. Sergeant Jones got hit. He was a black preacher that everybody loved, and I could see daylight through the hole in his head. I watched my best friend's head blown off by an AK-47. I stepped on punji steaks that were dipped in shit, got infected, took some antibiotics, and went back to the line. A grenade fragment caught me in the left upper arm. Surgeons couldn't get the metal out. I was overrun twice, had a flare blow up in my face, but nothing, nothing ever touched my mind. I had a job to do in Vietnam. And I had a job to do when I got back home. After the fierce mountain gorilla known as Mountain Guards made him an honorary trooper, Pratt became lost in the jungle for 3 days, out of touch with his unit. Word reached Morgan City that he was missing in action. Back home, Eunice Petty Pratt wrote in her notebook, "I keep on praying. I am still hoping and praying that the good Lord will bring our baby back home safe and sound and a much holier man. Who knows? He may even dedicate his life to God." When she heard that her son was safe, Eunice was so relieved that her writing turned uncharacteristically jingoistic. We are on a warpath. The devil's army against our lords. As for us, God is our captain, and we are marching on to victory. In the summer of 1967, Sergeant Elmer Pratt was rotated home to a country torn by the worst urban riots in U.S. history. African Americans were rising against ghetto conditions in Los Angeles, Baltimore, Newark, Chicago,
Cleveland, New York, Detroit, and Phoenix. Malcolm X had set the tone in a speech to black students from Mississippi. You'll get freedom by letting your enemy know that you'll do anything to get your freedom. Then you'll get it. It's the only way you'll get it. When you get that kind of attitude, they'll label you a crazy Negro, or they'll call you a crazy nigger. They don't say Negro. Or they'll call you an extremist, or a subversive, or seditious, or a red, or a radical. But when you stay radical long enough and get enough people to be like you, you'll get your freedom. Pratt's unit settled in at Fort Bragg, and he was assigned to drill Green Berets. I had no love for the Army, but I'd made good friends. He thought himself indifferent to military pomp and ceremony, but at an awards ceremony, he was curiously touched. We didn't even know our company commanders that well, but the idea that they would take the time to honor me for the few things I did, I was really touched by that. Water came to my eyes, I ain't gonna lie. My platoon was really tripping when the major pinned on my medals. I felt like my own little war was over, and I'm waiting for word from the elders. I'd done my year in NAM, already got my combat patch, made buck sergeant, got me a girlfriend off the post, lived in a brick house, drove a 65 Ford Fairlane drop top. The life of Riley, 20 years old and dumb as a stump. His unit was sent to Detroit to put down a race riot that had cost dozens of lives and threatened to destabilize the city. I hated the duty. We all hated it. Man, we were the 82nd Airborne, trained paratroopers. They took away our dignity as soldiers. One month we're risking our lives for our country, and the next we're getting ready to fire on our own people. I knew if the order came, I couldn't obey it. One day, some black paratroopers started firing at white National Guardsmen. Grenades, machine guns, a pitched battle. The Army hauled our asses out of there and hushed it up. Back at Bragg, I got word from the elders. Come home now. I didn't mind. Mama was alone with Daddy, and I was worried about them. Before I could finish filling out my resignation papers, things turned bad in Nam. Lyndon Johnson withdrew the early out option, and me and my unit were ordered back. My brother Tim was so pissed he wrote Johnson, accused him of going back on his word, said there were all kinds of young bloods he could send, not his brother Gerard, who was wounded twice. Somebody in the Pentagon wrote back that the president had no choice. We flew to Da Nang right in the middle of the Tet Offensive. We had to retake Hue City twice. I caught shrapnel in my upper arm and went blind for a while. His permanent medical record listed grenade fragments lodged in buttocks and upper arm, intermittent scotoma, and blurred vision. On this second tour, the war looked an even darker shade. I saw things I didn't used to notice. One day I was charged by a VC soldier with a bayonet. I shot him at close range and saw his face fly off. I began having nightmares about it, but the nightmares, my weapon didn't fire, and I'd wake up screaming just as he started to stick me in the throat. I began to see faces of people I'd killed. I'd always been bothered by the cowards that couldn't win at fistfights in a ladies' toilet, but got off on bullying the Vietnamese, kicking, terrorizing, killing. Women and children, it didn't matter. After I was made platoon leader, I saw two white guys, privates, raping a VC nurse. I hit one in the head with my rifle butt.
Later on, I caught two of my guys trying to hang an enemy soldier. Had a rope around his neck, threw it over a tree. They were pulling him up when I turned the corner. You can imagine what I thought, being black from the South. I said, "Hey man, you crazy?" They said, "Motherfucker had a grenade." I was angry at our officers for letting things like this happen, but they'd say, "Hey, we're at war. Guys lose their tempers. We can't watch them every second." I said, "Why not?" After a while, I began to see the war as another kind of racism. In boot camp and advanced infantry training, all we ever heard was gooks, Buddha heads, slopes, same way our daddies heard krauts and Japs. You got to make people subhuman before you kill them. I saw things I don't want to remember. I did things I don't want to remember. That second tour was a bad time. Pratt was sitting on a bunker outside Hughes City in April 1968 when word crackled over armed forces radio that Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed. "Hey," he said aloud, "what's happening back home? What's going on?" Later in the day, he heard a black activist named Bobby Seale in a radio interview. "You darn right we respect nonviolence," Seale said. "But to sit and watch ourselves be slaughtered like our brothers, we must defend ourselves, as Malcolm X said, by any means necessary." Seale was identified as one of the founders of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Geronimo wondered, what was that all about? He'd never run into any Panthers, black or otherwise. And we will stop there. We are in Chapter 3. We will pick up our first mention of the Black Panther Party. He's not even out of the army yet, so we have a ways to go. I guess I'll give one more bit of foreshadowing before we get to our callers. We heard Geronimo Pratt mention he took the sandbags in the tank and he put in extra layers because they were going over the mines. And he said, "Oh, wow, we hit a mine later and maybe that saved some lives, us having these extra sandbags." Foreshadowing. Foreshadowing. Sometimes it works that way in life. Like, this was constructive before. Maybe we should do this again. We shall see. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-POUND. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in, if we have folks who did not get to share the first time around at all, make sure you get a hand up now so that we don't miss you entirely. If you have comments, observations, thoughts to share, folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Retired firefighter in Florida.
Yes, sir. The term that Geronimo's mother used, human color, when referring, I forgot what she was referring to, but it reminded me of the same cliche that a lot of non-white people, especially non-white black people, use in order to kind of like brush off the incorrectness of race / racism by saying there's only one type of race and that's human race, you know, which really doesn't have a whole lot of logic to it. There was a brief reference to Emmett Till. They didn't mention his name, but it was a brief reference to it. I think it occurred in that encounter with the white female, and it definitely played a part when the white male father just went right into the home of Geronimo and his family. Vietnam, the Montagnards, was described to me as being having the same looks of non-white black people in this part of the world, or very similar looks. Because the non-white black male troops that were over there were kind of like surprised when they first saw this group of people who looked similar to them over in Southeast Asia. Tet Offensive was actually, from my understanding, the turning point as far as from the standpoint of this part of the world was basically kept promising about success. And the Tet Offensive basically exposed that lie at that point in time. And that was the only time that, quote unquote, U.S. forces actually did combat in a city-like area in the city of Wei. And they were also in Saigon. It was something that it was an attack that took place on a holiday that the Vietnamese have. Last but not least, the term "what's going on." The first thing came to my mind was, in my mind, is the greatest album ever written by Marvin Gaye, and to place it directly into this particular reading. The album, the motivation of the album that Marvin Gaye wrote, titled "What's Going On," was from his brother, who served in Vietnam, who did active combat in Vietnam also. And that's all I would say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Other folks who have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Are you?
Henry in Chicago, proceed.
All right. Thanks. Eunice Pratt, victim of racism, also confused. But I do appreciate what Geronimo Pratt said about him growing up avoiding, you know, derogatory terms like nigger and redneck. As you know, we always say on this show, no name calling. So I do appreciate that from her. Black self-respect to the father, defending black women in regards to not letting nobody disrespect black women like that. The stroke by the dad on page 19, you know, I'm kind of thinking they didn't give like a pinpoint reason, but I thought about John Henryism because in the beginning of the Pratts of Morgan City, it states that when he was talking about Jack Pratt, that he drove his trucks till they were almost junks themselves before school and after school on Saturdays and even holidays, and he drove his sons just as hard. So I'm just thinking that might have been, you know, just him working very hard, and, you know, he ended up with a stroke, even though they didn't really say it, but I kind of made that connection, like I said, to John Henryism. It's ironic that his brother Tim, who was beaten by the Klan, had a eerie ride in the hearse, like his father, to the hospital. That whole hearse thing was just kind of eerie, even though, you know, neither one of them died, but, you know, just riding in a hearse was just, you know, odd to me, you know, just reading that. Legionnaire and Deacons of Defense, the book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, by Charles Cobb, a lot of parallels there. And what was also interesting was when they were talking about the O'Neill Moore and David Creed on page 26, I went up and looked it up in the book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, Charles Cobb, and I found it on 212, where it says, on June 2nd, 1965, O'Neill Moore, who the year before had made local history by becoming the first black deputy sheriff in Washington Parish, was shot and killed while parked in his edge, on the edge of Bogalusa in his patrol car, a crime that remains unsolved. His partner, Creed Rogers, the second black deputy hired by the parish, was also wounded and lost the sight in one eye. So that was in the This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed by Charles Cobb. The reference to the white man, John Wayne, being the white man to protect, you know, obviously John Wayne, the actor, you know, and also it just sounds too close to John Brown, you know, the good white man who was who fights against racism, quote unquote. And the Tet Offensive in Da Nang. And what's so interesting is my dad was there. He was actually able to survive that war in total. But I remember him telling me about him being in Da Nang during the Tet Offensive. So that was pretty interesting. But he also told me another parallel here where he was talking about how racist it was in Vietnam because, you know, they kept hearing the name gooks and all kind of derogatory terms against the Vietnamese people. And same thing my dad had, you know, talked about in his experience in Vietnam. So, but that's all I had on my line.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Imagine that, name calling non-white people. Who would have thought? Mo in Dallas, did you have commentary, sir? Thank you for yielding.
Yes, I do. Thank you. I noted that, in Geronimo Pratt's early childhood, there were frequent occurrences of, in my opinion, crimes against black people that he didn't see as such. You know, I thought that was very interesting. The story with the fisherman's son, and which is which him and his brother got locked up. The Halloween story: black kids hurt some white kids for their candy, and the Klan was on a search and destroy. I don't know if that's the story that was if that was accurate or true, but it sounded like it could have been misinformation, in my opinion, based on the way that, you know, Pratt and his brother reacted to the fisherman's son. You know, he told that child, "We don't do that around here." And if that was accurate, I don't see why, you know, black children would take Halloween to accost white kids. You know, it just doesn't, it doesn't, I guess, mesh with the way that his side of the tracks is depicted, you see? So I'm thinking that those people will probably use that holiday and made an excuse to, you know, hurt some non-white victims. Racial tension were high during the Watts riots, and many blame it on black militants. We go back to, you know, blaming the victims. It's victim blaming. These people were upset for a reason, and it seemed like they were blaming the reaction and not the action in that case. That's all I have on my line. Thank you.
Negro militants always stirring up trouble, as it were. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
I think it begins on like page 31 and it goes into page 32, his like military, I guess, service. Seemed like he was very distinguished, and it was just interesting seeing how dedicated he was. And then in that same section, I thought the most interesting thing to me was the second portion of the reading was the rape, and it reminded me, I can't remember what book it was or which person you were interviewing. I want to say it was in Australia. I think there was like black males that were in the military, I guess, and they got prosecuted, maybe is it court-martialed and found guilty and hung. I can't remember the details. Maybe you can help me out, but I remember something like that, because I think they either were accused of rape. And so it was just interesting that it seemed like nothing happened to these people that raped this Vietnamese lady. That's all I had. Thank you.
Much obliged. The Black African, Black Soldier Blues, I think is the documentary film. We had one of the white female filmmakers from Australia, no less, on the program way, 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 way back in 2011. And that is one of the very sad parts of the film. They had lots of black World War II soldiers. They had a long fight about black soldiers even being in Australia because they got a whites-only policy, global system. But they had these black soldiers who, much like O.J. Simpson, falsely accused of some crime against a white woman. And she includes, I think, in the documentary film, they included like two or three of these letters that some of these black soldiers were able to write the night before they were going to be hanged for allegedly raping a white woman or whatever it is that they were accused of doing. But that's in the archive. She read a few of the letters, and then it's also in the documentary film. But yes, many trifling, tragic moments throughout the history, and with black veterans, the treatment of black veterans, like, disgraceful throughout. Other folks with commentary.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Gosh, good evening. I get where you're going with the parallels between Mr. Simpson, Mr. Pratt. It makes a lot of sense. Second book, I remember in the book club, where we get an inside look of in depth racism in early 20th century Louisiana. Other book being Serena and Venus's father, Blacks Fighting the Klan, same as in his book. Think that you can say that that's all true. Not sure about his family having the power to keep the white people out of their side. You know, when some random white guy just kicks in the door looking for them, but I get, you know, sometimes we glorify things. It's just not logical. In Louisiana, no killing non-white people in the name of white supremacy. And I leave my line. Thank you.
Much of, I did think of Richard Williams' Black and White, The Way I See It, 2014. That was a pretty good one. And he does talk about, but even with that, you know, when I remembered, he didn't describe any stories where they had like the Klan like quivering and, you know, white people were afraid to come. That's not what he said at all. He describes getting vengeance on the Klan for what they did in terrorizing his friends and him, his friends, his family, all of the above. But it was vengeance, and it wasn't like he had some army or something like that. Like, they know not to do that. That's not what he described at all. I mean, it's dramatic, very believable. I don't remember having a whole lot of folks saying that they thought Mr. Williams was lying or what have you, but I mean, it very much fit within the, I don't know, that's a little tough to believe that black people would have that type of might to have white people fearful of stepping on their side of town, that sort of thing. Self-defense, retaliation, vengeance, totally different. Lots of that. That nonviolent stuff will get you killed. Some of that's in there. In fact, I was even thinking of, we've had a number of different books where they've talked of black retaliation and fighting back. Some of that's even in The Half Has Never Been Told, Edward Baptist, even back to the slave days. Anywho, much obliged, Thomas in New York. Another great one. Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It. Let's see. I'll get in a few of the notes I took before we wrap. Let's see. Eunice Pratt, definitely a victim of racism when she's talking about Shakespeare as the human color and that black folks didn't end the Civil War, whites did. I think even Abraham Lincoln and a number of white scholars would disagree with her and would say that it was black people stealing themselves, as it were, out of slavery and going to join the Union Army and all the rest, that was a deciding factor in who won the war. But whatever. VGQ to her, too. Let's see. Racial violence was rare. That's the sentence. I just paused like, how can that be in a system of white supremacy, much less in Louisiana in the 1940s, like before World War II? Like, how is that logically possible? Like, black people are being lynched at this time, even in Louisiana, and nothing is done about it. Like, I mean, he's not a historian, so I mean, I'm not, his memory doesn't have to be perfect, but I mean, there are a few of these moments. There'll be more of these to come. He says, when Geronimo was 9 or 10, he and a classmate were swimming at the point. This reminded me of Richard Williams, too, because there are so many of these in the Cal's Book Club, Cal's Guests, where black people at the swimming pool and somebody has to die. Richard Williams, I think that was ended up connected to the Klan incident where they didn't have anywhere to swim and we can't go to the pool, can't go to the lake. So we would go swim in the ditch and a black person would drown, or the Klan would come and hit them with a rock and they would die. All tons of these type of incidents. The Point, Tidal Surge, The River, a group of white boys threw rocks. Yeah, we've heard 50 billion of these in the system of white supremacy. And he says, 3 days later, little Geronimo watched in shock as a fisherman unraveled the body of his trout line. He was a very dark boy, almost black, but the crabs nibbled off his skin and turned him bluish white. This is almost identically played out in Black and White, The Way I See It, and the horror that Richard Williams had about a black white people killing some of his black friends, school children, lots of them. It was a white person ran over one of his friends in a car and killed him. He was like 9, 10 years old, something really. Tons of these type of stories. Total worthlessness of black life. Let's see. Black self-respect. His dad quitting his job because the white men made all of these crude remarks about raping black females. That's what I mean. That can't be on the same page where you say racial violence is rare, and then you say that your dad had to quit his job because the white men just kept talking about their penchant for raping black females. That right there would seem to suggest, no, racial violence was pretty common. If they're raping black females all the time and killing black children, everyday occurrence, it would seem. Let's see. Black self-respect for his father, though. Love it. How common it is, cowbell, white men, white women, white children raping black people. Let's see. Charity Hospital. We get so many book club mentions. Katrina after the flood. This is not the first time that we have heard of the infamous Charity Hospital, now closed in New Orleans, that has, or did at one time, keep a number of black people alive. Looks like his father was able to stay alive this time, going to Charity Hospital. Let's see. His father pronounced dead 3 times, and he still is able to make it back. Like, wow. Let's see. The whole whistling moment, like, just trying to process all of this, where he said he blamed his friend. The people who are most to blame are classified as white. And we didn't even get a wolf whistle accusation here. All we got was he said hi. That was it. Not, you know, he wiggled his hips at her or flashed his zipper or called her a name. Anything like that. He just said hi. And that was enough to get punched. We don't do that. Like, what? Just hi? You don't say hi? Woo. And again, racial violence was rare. I would put this here. If you get hit even by a non-white person because you said hi to a white person, that is racial violence that white people are to blame for. And the boys, I didn't do nothing wrong. Yes, you did. We have an agreement. We don't speak. I'm like, dang. Let's see. So they come, yeah, very Emmett Till. This sort of thing happened all the time. We get an accurate assessment from one of his family members, his siblings, he said. What's me and Gerard charged with? He was remembering something his sister Virginia had told him. Slavery isn't dead, Tim. It's just changed form. That's still true, 2021. Let's see. Oh, and we even got a white dog moment. The cop locked the young malfectors in a cell next to the canine kennel. That happens so regularly. White dog, one of our favorites from the book club. Even after all of this, he says they're in prison. I'd have been mad anyway, but they're in greater confinement. Imagine that. He muttered to his brother, we didn't say a word, and we ended up in jail. Imagine that. He still blamed the fisherman's son. Dang, it's my I'm a child. I just said hi, and I'm to blame, not these terrorist white people who are kidnapping children and everything. Let's see. Thankfully, they have a white friend who saw this and was able to get them out of greater confinement. And we have another example of black self-respect. Eunice Pratt walked to the complaining girl's house and warned her father that the next time he entered the family residence without knocking, he would be met by something a little stronger than 1 Corinthians. Black self-respect. I love it. Let's see. And he says it again. He has it in quotes. Geronimo explained years later, I didn't blame the police. I blamed the other boy. That was the way I was conditioned. Going to jail was a learning experience, but I didn't learn nothing from it. Color consciousness crept up on me and the other kids. We knew nothing about black rage. Wouldn't have understood a concept like that. Black rage about what? I had to pause there just because, man. Flipping O.J. Simpson. I just said in the middle of the O.J. Simpson trial, Colin Ferguson, a black male, gets on a train in New York and shoots up all the white people. The Long Island Railroad Massacre. So that happened in 93, I believe. But that trial is going on while the O.J. Simpson process is occurring in 94, I believe, even into the early part of 95. But his defense, Colin Ferguson, he commits this act. And then he's his own attorney. He fires his lawyers, his own attorney. His defense is black rage in response to the system of white supremacy. And people are even, because these are happening concurrently, people are questioning, is this going to come up in the O.J. Simpson case? So I see this here, like, woo, black, are you serious? Black rage. You could check this, like, people talked about this. I think there are books associated with this. Black rage, Colin Ferguson, racism, white supremacy. Anyway. But they didn't know anything about this, confused about racism, white supremacy at the time. And then the Klan. I cannot imagine this being a one-time thing. Like, I just don't believe that this was the first time that the Klan did something violent or criminal when they attacked his brother. I just, that's hard to believe, in my view. And I agree. I said the exact same thing as Mo in Dallas. I do not believe this at all. We just read a whole book of Jeffrey Toobin, line every other page. Johnny Cochran called Darda nigger and all the rest of it. I do not believe that some black children beat up and smacked around some white children. Give me your Snickers bar. I do not believe that at all. I believe that is a total lie. We'll just say that they raped the white girl and they stole some candy from these children, and that'll give us reason. Yeah, we got to go beat up the nigger to show them, keep them in their place. They're going out and roughing up. I do not believe that at all. With everything that we've heard, particularly as he said, if we're codified to the point we don't even speak to white people, who is it that's gonna, yeah, we're gonna wait to Halloween and go get them and steal some chuck? Get out of here. That's not even believable. Let's see. Yeah, the black self-respect again, like lots of examples. What does that say? The fruit does not fall far from the tree. The whole family comes out to defend Tim. And to run off the Klan, believable. There are a number of stories of this, black people doing this sort of thing. Let's see. And then the consequences, like having these sort of incidents of terrorism where it ends up impacting his confidence at school because he's having medical problems and seizures because of all this, like terrorism, call things by their proper name. This is terrorism designed to have that sort of a lifelong traumatic impact on you and your whole family. Let's see. Anything else? Make sure. Get in. Grambling. Lots of HBCU mentions. Oh, he says, let's see. He talks about that's in the archives, the whole program on the Deacons of Defense. Let's see. The retaliations, that is true, incidents of black self-respect have been deliberately obliterated from the record. We've done a number of programs talking about that as well, to get away from that narrative of black people being cowards. Incidentally, he did talk about with Halloween that they dressed up as Lafitte the Pirate. These people should be thought of as like slave traders and racist. They even have some of the so-called black projects in New Orleans named Lafitte. Again, these are slave trading white racist pirates, not people to be celebrated. Pirates of the Caribbean and all the rest of it. Let's see. He said he was talking about the elders. They encouraged him to get skills, go to Vietnam. There was a lot of that. Black people who might even be said Mr. Fuller could be thought of in that manner, but black people who went to Vietnam or Korean War to get skills, training, so that they could come back and help other black people. He said that like explicitly from what he was told by black people there. He said we had to develop a new generation of black warriors or the Klan was going to overwhelm us. And I was thinking, what? We're in a system of white supremacy. But then the next sentence is, they were already overwhelming us. Thank you. Be truthful about things. That's what I mean about, then it can't be true that there was no racial violence if you were overwhelmed by the Klan. Let's see. Then he says, make sure I get it right. Geronimo was promoted to squad leader and awarded the soldier's medal, but before he had a chance to pin it on, he was wounded. We were patrolling in Jeeps. And that's capital J, Jeeps, almost like Ford Bronco, Jeeps, cleaning out pockets of VC in the Central Highlands. Sergeant Maddox was in the point vehicle, kicking ass as usual, and I was right behind. He was our protector, our John Wayne. I say, watch those metaphors. In fact, they're talking right now about taking the name down from the airport in California, that's named John Wayne Airport, because of his dedication to white supremacy. He didn't spend his time protecting Negroes. A white guy from Arkansas with 14 years in the Little Rock Nine, he was probably out there fussing at Elizabeth Eckbert and company. There was no racism around here. Anybody said the N-word, we'd have whipped their ass. I just say that this can't be true because this is an entire war of white supremacy racism, which is what he said and retired firefighter, a number of people have said. Just to have white people give some lame excuse to go bomb and shoot up all these non-white people, the entire reason that he's here, Sergeant Maddox, is to practice racism, white supremacy. It doesn't matter if he's kind about it. Doesn't matter if he's calling you a nigger or chink or gook or slope or whatever, slant eyes, and all the rest that they bragged about and did daily, hourly, while they were there. This is a campaign of racism, white supremacy. I would say every white person who is here, chaplain, medic, whatever, you are in support of white supremacy racism. You don't want to be a part of it. Muhammad Ali, you know what to do. Bill Clinton, you know what to do, right? And Bill Clinton. Anyway, the sandbags, already mentioned that. I guess I'll ask. The one day some black paratroopers started firing at white National Guardsmen, grenades, machine guns, a pitched battle. The army hauled our asses out of there and hushed it up, when he's talking about later when they're sending out troopers to respond to some of the rioting that's happening, so-called, and even his response to the assassination of Dr. King. This is like the second book we've heard in short succession that's writing around the time of the assassination of Dr. King, White Dog, as well, from last summer. The black people fighting back, lots of that and more of that to come in this book. Black people fighting back, counter violence. Black people are not cowards. A lot of this gets, and he even says they hushed it up. They quieted it down. Black people fighting back even against the National Guard. My goodness, I don't know how this would sound now after the siege. Citizens and National Guardsmen fighting it out with grenades and weapons in a pitched battle. Yikes. Especially this week. I think they had to stop the hearings because of threats that there might be more violence. My goodness. We'll stop there. We already have, I guess, the warning, or I won't say warning, but we already have the teaser from Bobby Seale, the Black Panther Party, to come. I will stop there. What's going on mentioned as well, same time period. I'll stop there. I guess we could get one, two. We have two quick comments, then we can wrap up. Two quick comments. Anything folks need to get in before we conclude?
Yes, sir. Mr. Pratt certainly did listen to the quote unquote elders. Because the 82nd and 101st Airborne were two elite organizations within the U.S. Army. They jumped out of perfectly well-flying airplanes and were trained into small arm weapons experts, become experts at that, you know, and... matter of fact, Eisenhower ordered for the Little Rock 9, the 82nd Airborne in 1957. That's what the unit that was at Little Rock High School, at that Central High School at that time. And so they, it was a pretty elite group that he joined, so he was well skilled at killing people, and I would identify, you know, war is hypocrisy in itself. I wouldn't be surprised if he himself killed a lot of non-white people in Vietnam before he came back. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
For sure, retired firefighter. Anybody, we have another final comment, or folks satisfied?
I'll make a quick one. The white person who ran over Mr. Williams' friend was a white woman, the mayor's wife. And I wanted to say, Mr. Pratt, he was definitely, he sounded a lot like a lot of the professional athletes. Just so dedicated. We'll go out there with an infection, not take the time he needed, you know, go back. Kind of like how he described his father, a hard worker, a relentless worker, but just seemed like he was in pain, strapping wounds, didn't let them fight pass it up right. He was back out there. I wonder if that had to do with how he felt comfortable around his troops. Because, like so many people said, of course, there was racism during that war amongst the soldiers. Probably didn't want to be alone, you know, with people he didn't know. But I just thought, said, man, he was a dedicated soldier, for sure. I need my mom. Thank you.
John Henryism, I think one of our callers mentioned earlier in reference to his father. I mean, Oof, that certainly might count right there. John Henryism, to have shrapnel in your shoulder. Can you imagine? Like, in all these different... He said a flare blew up in his face, going over landmines, and give me a Band-Aid. Penicillin. He said he's stuck. They would do the spears. I forgot the exact name, but they would do the spears with the feces on the tip. He would step on one. Ah. Give some, you know, antibiotics. Be right back. Like, are you serious? Like, man, come on. Come on.
Bungee stick.
Thank you. Thank you, John. We had a Cows listener ask me about a book to read on Vietnam. There are many, but I would not have thought this, Last Man Standing, is one on Vietnam, but it absolutely would qualify. There are many more. Lots of talk about that as we go. But yeah, John Henryism, I think, would certainly come to mind with John Geronimo Pratt. His come. In fact, he suffers lifelong injuries as we continue reading the book, and he's doing his years in solitary confinement, and he's talking about some of these injuries that he collected in Vietnam that have not healed properly, and some of the lifelong health problems that he has as a result of these different injuries that, you know, he's collecting at a very young age. But keep that in mind as we continue to read. We'll pick up there next week, next Thursday, Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. We'll be here tomorrow, Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. Hopefully we'll have some constructive suggestions. Much obliged for folks tuning in. I don't know if this is as exciting. They don't have like 50,000 made-for-TV dramas and all the rest of it, although there are a lot of documentaries on Geronimo Pratt and the Black Panther Party where he's featured as a part of it. So there is a lot of viewing material, nowhere near as much as O.J. Simpson, which should be a problem because, I mean, he actually had to go to prison for 25 years where there's like no doubt, like people can have some doubt about O.J. Simpson. There is no doubt Geronimo Pratt 1,000% innocent, did not commit these crimes, 27 years in greater confinement. Like, this shit, in fact, people, if you know about that, man, getting to O.J. Simpson, like, oh my God, Mark Furman and all the rest of it, like, let's end it now. Like, let's wrap it up. They spent 4 hours. We can wrap this up in 30 minutes. Like, let's ride, let Geronimo Pratt ride, and yeah, we can get back to prosecuting Mark Furman and the people respond. In fact, the triflingness of this, they never even investigated. Like, who actually committed this murder here? Like, did we make any effort to even go out and solve that crime? No, we don't. Nah. Value of life in the system of white supremacy. We'll pick up next week. Much obliged for folks participating. I guess if you need a book... Yeah, if you need a book, let me know. That is kind of an annoyance, but if you do need a book, let me know. Should be available if you want to follow along as we read. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. No aspect of COINTELPRO or solving this problem will be improved by us being intoxicated. In addition to being sober, man, I'd say hunker down still. They had to shut down the hearings. Threats of white violence at the Capitol still. Like, if you got to go out, be very alert to what's happening around you. If it looks like people are being, anybody, white, non-white, they're being loud, hostile, exit. It is not a time for verbal confrontations with random strangers for any reason. You can exit, call enforcement officials, make a plan, but be exiting, not confronting. All of that said, if you are going out, it's something serious, important, whatever it is, you're sober, you are buckled, driver or passenger. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. Again, we need all of our vigilance, and we're trying to avoid the Mark Furmans of the known universe. Small things we can do, being sober, being buckled, not on the cell phone. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. We heard it from this week's reading specifically, no name calling. It seems like that is a core component. The business mechanics of white supremacy, racism, we got to call them names. We got to call them names. We got, in fact, it's so important we get them to call each other names. It's in the 10 stops for a reason. No name calling. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.